Game with me, Professor Giles Yeo, this Monday to Friday, lunchtime at 1:45. To listen on your smart speaker, just say Play Radio 4.
This is Radio 4 on 92 to 95 FM on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker.
Good morning. It's 6 o'clock on Monday, the 9th of February. This is Today with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson.
Good morning. The headlines today. Sir Keir Starmer is to address Labour MPs as he fights to save his job after yesterday's dramatic resignation of his Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney. We'll hear from Labour MPs, from the Leader of the Opposition, Kemi Badenoch, and the Minister and Labour veteran, Baroness Smith. And the British pro-democracy campaigner Jimmy Lai has been sentenced to 20 years in prison by a court in Hong Kong.
Also in today's programme, a triumphant celebration of Latino heritage or an affront to the greatness of America. We'll discuss the cultural significance of the Super Bowl halftime performance, which pitched Donald Trump against the world's most listened to artist. Prince William is in Saudi Arabia for his first official visit. Given the country's human rights record, just how tricky is that trip going to be diplomatically? And poet Wendy Cope picks the story that ignited and continues to fuel her love of reading.
What's enchanting about the Pooh books is the characters. The characters are so funny and interesting, and there's a lot of kindness and love in this book. Pooh is a really nice chap.
Winnie the Pooh, in case you had any doubts. That's all after the BBC News, read for us this morning by Tom Sanders.
Sir Keir Starmer will address Labour MPs today as he fights to shore up his leadership, which has been threatened by the scandal surrounding Lord Mandelson. The Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney, resigned yesterday, saying he took full responsibility for advising Sir Keir to appoint the peer as the UK's ambassador to Washington. Here's our political correspondent, Ian Watson.
When he addresses his restless MPs tonight, Sir Keir Starmer will know that potential leadership challengers will be in the audience. But as there's no one clear successor, that might mean that he'll have an opportunity to regain the political initiative. Some of his MPs are wary of a leadership contest because they believe the government can't survive another period of introspection and infighting. Others are just worried their favoured candidate might not win. But the questions about the Prime Minister's judgment predate the latest Epstein revelations. And there are a significant number of his colleagues who use phrases about his leadership, such as drinking in the last chance saloon, last throw of the dice, and even the final reset. And while the loss of Morgan McSweeney could facilitate that reset, some of the former Chief of Staff's allies are now suggesting other heads should be ruling over the Mandelson affair. With a difficult by-election this month and crucial elections in May, Morgan McSweeney's departure hasn't bought Sir Keir job security.
A court in Hong Kong has sentenced the pro-democracy campaigner Jimmy Lai to 20 years in prison. The media tycoon, who's a British citizen, was convicted in December on charges of foreign collusion and sedition. Martin Yip sent this report from outside the court.
This is the harshest punishment yet handed out under Hong Kong's strict national security law, which was imposed by China in 2020 in response to large and sometimes violent pro-democracy protests. Jimmy Lai nodded as the judge announced his sentence, while his wife and former reporters from his now-defunct Apple Daily newspaper burst into tears. Rights groups have condemned the 20-year term, calling it effectively a death sentence for the 78-year-old and a grave injustice. Mr. Lai's family described it as draconian and cruel. Last month, Sir Keir Starmer raised Jimmy Lai's case with China's President Xi Jinping when the two leaders met in Beijing. The Prime Minister previously said that securing his release was a priority for his government.
The Prince of Wales will begin his first official trip to Saudi Arabia today. The visit will focus on trade, energy and young people. Our senior royal correspondent Daniela Ralph reports from Riyadh.
After a week in which the royal family have been under intense scrutiny as a result of the Epstein files, the Prince of Wales's visit to Saudi Arabia is an attempt to return to business as usual, if that is possible. He'll be in the country for 3 days at the request of the UK government, who view it as their most strategically important relationship in the region. Forging stronger ties with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman will be a priority for Prince William. Saudi Arabia is modernising culturally and economically, but remains an authoritarian regime ruled by an absolute monarchy where political protesters are severely sanctioned.
MPs have criticised the standard of social housing in England, saying hundreds of thousands of homes fail to meet basic standards. Members of the Commons Housing Communities and Local Government Committee say they're also concerned that a new decent home standard won't be brought in for another decade. The government says it's taking action to drive up the quality of social housing. Here's Tara Welsh.
Today's report says too many people are still suffering with appalling housing and don't have their complaints treated seriously. Conditions are generally better in homes rented by councils and housing associations than the private sector, but the MPs say 430,000 social homes fail to meet basic standards. Last month, the government published a new decent home standard for the rental sector, but landlords won't have to comply until 2035. Ministers say they're encouraging them to raise standards sooner.
Japan's main stock index soared by more than 5% in early trading after the country's first female prime minister, Sanae Takaichi, secured a resounding victory in yesterday's election. It's the first time the Nikkei has climbed above 57,000 points. The coalition led by Ms. Takaichi's Liberal Democrat Party won more than two-thirds of the seats in the lower house of parliament, paving the way for higher fiscal spending and a massive tax cut. A white supremacist who shot dead 51 people at two mosques in New Zealand has appeared in court in Wellington to try to withdraw his guilty plea. Brenton Tarrant is serving a whole life sentence after the attack on worshippers during Friday prayers in Christchurch in 2019. Our correspondent Katie Watson reports.
It was in March 2020, a year after the attack, that Brenton Tarrant pleaded guilty to carrying out the deadliest mass shooting in modern-day New Zealand. This week's hearing seeks to withdraw that guilty plea and appeal against his sentence. The crux of his argument is that he wasn't able to make rational decisions because of what he has described as torturous and inhumane prison conditions. If Tarrant is allowed to withdraw his guilty plea, the case would potentially go to trial on all charges. If he's not allowed to retract his plea, there'll be another hearing later in the year to consider his appeal against his sentence.
American football's showpiece event, the Super Bowl, has been won by the Seattle Seahawks. They beat the New England Patriots by 29 points to 13 at Levi's Stadium in California. The halftime show by the Puerto Rican artist Bad Bunny has been criticised by Donald Trump as one of the worst ever after it was performed almost entirely in Spanish. Writing on social media, the US president claimed, "Nobody understands a word this guy is saying."
Tom, thank you very much indeed. We'll be talking to someone who does understand what he was saying a little bit later in the programme and why it was quite a significant moment. At 7 minutes past six, though, let's get the weather forecast this morning. More rain, Sarah Keith Lucas?
Oh, I'm afraid so, Nick. Good morning to you. Yes, we've still got over 100 flood warnings in force across central and southern England, as well as eastern Scotland too. And there is some more rain in the forecast, still unsettled for the next few days, and that'll particularly be focused in the southwest once again today. So starting with the detail for southwest England and South Wales, a few showers around this morning, but into the afternoon, more persistent rain will roll its way in. The winds are going to be picking up with the arrival of that wetter weather too. It is going to be mild at around 10 or 11 degrees. Through southeast England, eastern England and the Midlands, quite a cloudy, drizzly sort of morning, but it will brighten up a little bit, I think, a few glimpses of blue sky for a time into this afternoon, 11 or 12 degrees here. For North Wales, Northern England and all of Scotland, low cloud and drizzle from the word go, some fog patches in the east of Scotland. There'll be some heavier showers coming and going really through the morning. Into the afternoon, fewer showers. Still a little bit cloudy and grey for some, but there'll be a bit of sunshine, particularly northwest Scotland, and brisk southeasterly winds for the Northern Isles, 8 to 10 degrees here. For Northern Ireland today, some fog patches first thing, but they'll clear away to leave some brighter spells through the morning. But the afternoon does look cloudier, some outbreaks of rain, 8 or 9 degrees. And then through tonight, it's going to stay pretty cloudy, damp and frost-free. Light patchy rain almost anywhere. Overnight lows tonight around about 4 to 8 degrees. Still cloudy and damp into Tuesday, but some better news. It does turn a little drier and brighter and colder into the end of the week.
Oh, that's something to look forward to at least. Thank you, Sarah. Let's take a first look at the front pages at 9 minutes past six. It will not surprise you to hear that most of them focus on the resignation of the Downing Street Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney. Blame me. is the Daily Mirror's headline this morning. It says the Prime Minister's top aide shouldered the blame for the appointment of Lord Mandelson, but adds that the pressure remains on Sir Keir Starmer.
The Eye quotes a Scottish Labour source who calls Sir Keir a dead man walking. How long can Starmer cling on, asks the Daily Mail, alongside a picture of Angela Rayner, potential leadership challenger, getting her hair done. She posted that on TikTok. Look who's ready for her close-up on the steps of number 10, it says.
But the Times quotes an unnamed source who points out that Miss Rayner's tax affairs will make replacing Sir Keir difficult for her. They also suggest it will be hard for the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, to become leader because of what they call his previous ties to Lord Mandelson. Although in recent days, he's described the peer's actions as irresponsible and reckless.
The Guardian calls Morgan McSweeney the campaign wizard who lost his magic touch. It says allies of the Prime Minister will hope his departure will help quell the mounting anger among MPs over his leadership. But The Express says blaming Mr. McSweeney for Lord Mandelson's appointment won't wash. According to The Sun, the Prime Minister has not only lost his human shield, but his political brain.
The Daily Telegraph says allies of Morgan McSweeney have questioned whether others in Number 10 should also bear responsibility for what's happened. The paper said that fingers were pointed at the National Security Advisor Jonathan Powell over claims that he, too, was supportive of Lord Mandelson's appointment as US ambassador. It says he didn't respond to a request for comment, though senior Whitehall figures firmly denied the claim.
So let us reflect at the beginning of 3 hours in which there'll be a lot of politics on what a difference a few days, a few hours can make when you're fighting for your political survival. Just last Thursday, the Prime Minister described his chief of staff as an essential member of my team. Just yesterday morning, the man Downing Street chose to defend Keir Starmer, his ally Pat McFadden, the Work and Pension Secretary, seemed to echo that view when Laura Koonsberg asked him about calls for Mr. McSweeney to pay the price for the appointment of his friend Peter Mandelson.
I see no point in that whatsoever. In fact, you know, I think if the Prime Minister stays there, I don't think that would make any difference at all. And to call for changes of staff, I've seen this before. I don't think it makes a difference. I think the Prime Minister should continue with what he's doing.
I've seen it before. I don't think it makes a difference. But then a few hours later, this happened.
Now, some breaking news here in the UK in the world of politics. Number 10 has confirmed that Morgan McSweeney has resigned as the Prime Minister's chief of staff.
With McSweeney gone, the inevitable question is whether Starmer will be next to go, or can the Prime Minister reset, or at least try to reset his government once again? Here's the view of a Labour MP who rebelled against cuts to winter fuel and other benefit payments, Rachel Maskell, speaking on Radio 4's The Westminster Hour.
Let's listen very carefully over the coming days to see that Keir Starmer has really understood how serious it is, the situation, what he has to do to build that inclusive party, and if he can achieve that, if he puts the agenda of inclusion, of building the confidence that he's going to address those inequalities, not just in his party, but across the country, then of course we will see where we get to. But if he cannot do that, if he hasn't understood the seriousness of the situation, then I think he will find it very difficult to continue.
That word, if, once again. It's reported that days ago, Maskell hugged her leader at a private party at Chequers, despite having told him he has to quit. Some in the party are giving more public support and urging caution in the face of growing leadership speculation. Here's Labour MP Clive Effort with this warning for his colleagues.
My message to them is to be careful what you wish for. Us plunging ourselves into what will probably take nearer 6 months to go through the long drawn out democratic process that we have in the Labour Party to decide a new leader is not what we need to do.
And what of the man who helped turn the Labour Party into an election winning force alongside Peter Mandelson? Alistair Campbell took to his Rest of Politics podcast to blame the wider political culture for the mess his party's in.
But because of the nature of our politics, the quality, if you like, of our politicians and the political gene pool, the nihilism of much of the mainstream media, the anarchy of social media, with dissonance, hypocrisy, short-termism, naivety, industrialised rage and willful ignorance off the scale, that we're becoming almost ungovernable, that neither the parties nor the public are really prepared to face up to the big things that need to happen to turn this country around.
almost ungovernable. In the next 3 hours, we'll hear the views of the Leader of the Opposition, Kemi Badenoch, the Minister Number 10's chosen to defend the Prime Minister, and Labour backbenchers who want to see change, if not of leader, certainly of approach.
It's 14 minutes past six now. Let's turn to Japan, where the political situation is far less delicately balanced. Japan's ruling party has won a snap election by a landslide. Our Tokyo correspondent Shima Khalil is following developments. Shima, what's happened in the last few hours?
Sanae Takaichi's political gamble of calling a snap election in the depths of winter here in Japan, hugely unusual timing, has really paid off. Looking at the front pages of the Japanese newspapers, they all have a spread with pretty much the same headline: a landslide for the ruling LDP governing coalition led by Sanae Takaichi, securing well over the two-thirds, which essentially gives them this majority threshold that means that they have near total legislative control, clear way to faster, more decisive policy making, and no political constraints. And this is a big turnaround for the ruling party that had suffered a humiliating defeat back in 2024 when Sanae Takaichi's predecessor also called a snap election but lost badly under the cloud of political and financial scandals and Japanese households angry about the crisis of cost of living. These issues remain, but Sanae Takaichi's popularity is the different element here. In the 3.5 months in power, she has really managed to cultivate a celebrity-like image for herself, appearing next to Donald Trump on the USS Washington here in Japan, this drumming session with the Korean president. All of these viral moments have really carried her as a different prime minister and leader to her predecessors. And that really, these polls hovering around the 70% are the ones that turn things around for her Liberal Democratic Party and the coalition. I think now it's less about performance and more about policy. Takaichi is known for her pro-business stance. She wants big business, big government spending, tax cuts. And there's going to be a pressure on how she's going to deliver that and at what cost. She has really good relations with Donald Trump, who endorsed her and congratulated her win. But she has managed to infuriate Beijing when she talked about Japan possibly getting militarily involved if China attacked Taiwan, a red line for Beijing, who are Japan's biggest trading partner. So that balance between the United States, their biggest defense ally, and China, an angry China, as their biggest trading partner, is going to be very delicate indeed and is going to define her premiership going forward.
Shima Khalil in Tokyo, thank you.
17 minutes past six. That election result in Japan cheered up people buying Japanese stocks and shares. There's been a big increase in the market there. With more on that and indeed the rest of the day's business news, here's Leanna Byrne.
Hi, Nick. Yeah, I think we're all saying it. It's a gamble that paid off. And because of that, Sanae Takaichi, she now has a resounding mandate for economic policies, which include higher spending and taxes. Chris Cicluna is head of research at Daiwa Capital Markets Europe. Good morning, Chris.
Anna.
Chris, talk to us about what Takaichi trade is. What did she come into this election with?
Well, the Takaichi trade is very different depending on which market you're participating in. If you're looking at the stock market, I think it's fair to say that Takaichi trade means big gains. I mean, Japanese investors in Japanese stocks have long been believers in Takaichi. They're confident that Japanese firms will benefit from her pledge to end austerity. They love her promises of more investment to boost growth. They like the fact that she's identified several strategic sectors, such as defense and AI, to benefit from extra policy support. And it's notable that defense stocks were among those to rally hardest most today. And stock market investors also welcome her commitment to consider a 2-year cut in the sales tax on food. But I think it's fair to say that investors in Japanese government bonds in the yen are a lot more agnostic, if not downright skeptical about her intentions. Japanese government debt's extremely high, and investors in bonds in the yen want to know how she intends to finance her plans.
Well, let's talk about
public spending.
Yeah, let's talk about the public finances, because this is where some of the tension lies, isn't it? Japan, it has an enormous stock of government debt, and she's talked about spending more on cutting taxes. So talk to us about what that means for fiscal policy. Investors, they don't seem to be relaxed about that, particularly in the bond market.
Yeah, the bond market's very worried about whether or not there's just going to be enough demand out there for those bonds that the government's going to have to sell to keep itself running. That's all the more acute because there's so much debt out there already, and because the Bank of Japan, which is the biggest holder of government bonds, is determined to reduce its holdings going forward because, of course, inflation's back, and so they need to be thinking about tightening monetary policy. So there is a question about who's going to buy those bonds going forward. I mean, the good news is that actually government debt as a share of GDP has been falling for the past few years in Japan because growth has been back, and the rate of growth has been higher than the rate of interest on government debt. But going forward with higher inflation, those interest rates on government debt are going to rise, and the debt burden, debt interest payment burden of the government will rise too. So we certainly don't expect government debt to share of GDP to keep declining in Japan.
And we talk about inflation, you know, fair enough, there's growth, but for the average person, they're not used to inflation, are they? They're a little bit, you know, this is why they were brought to the polls, wasn't it really?
It was indeed. I mean, to be fair, wages have been rising at their strongest rates for some 30 to 40 years in Japan, but they haven't been rising quickly enough as general prices. So inflation has been higher. Wages in real terms have been declining. We do think that inflation's actually going to be falling this year. It's going to fall below 2% very soon. And we're looking at very strong wage gains in this coming spring's wage settlement round. So households should benefit from stronger purchasing power this year, which should be good news for growth.
And just very quickly, Chris, what does this mean for the Bank of Japan?
It means probably the Bank of Japan will still be looking to raise rates, even though inflation's coming down over the near term. The near term downward pressure on inflation is really due to special factors such as falling rice prices, as well as some Takeuchi's temporary measures to suppress inflation. And in due course, inflation is going to pick back up again, and the Bank of Japan will keep normalizing rates. We look for a next rate hike in the second quarter of this year.
We'll be looking out for it. Chris Scicluna, Head of Research at Daiwa Capital Markets Europe, thank you so much for joining us. Now let's talk about the carmaker Stellantis, because it had a brutal end to the week. Its share price fell by around a quarter by Friday. That came after it announced a major scaling back of its electric vehicle ambitions. Tinika Fricke is Senior Fund Manager at W1M. Tinika, why is Stellantis backing out of EVs to this extent?
Yes, good morning. Well, Stellantis is in good or bad company, depending how you call it, because Ford and General Motors made sort of similar decisions. So this is really about that there's just not as much demand for certain EV cars in the US particularly than they expected. Car companies, they need to plan 3 to 5 years ahead in making a car before they can launch it in the market. So Stellantis, you know, had a forecast, particularly for trucks, EV trucks, that just didn't work out. So they writing it down. What the market was surprised on was the scale of the write down. It was bigger than expected, about 22 billion euros. It's a big sum. But also part of that was down to some operational issues. So a Stellantis specific issue rather than a US EV issue. And also in December, they sort of reiterated their confidence in their guidance for the year. And then 2 months later, they missed that guidance. So there is a trust issue as well.
And it's a trend in the car manufacturing industry. It's not the only company that's done this.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. So Ford and General Motors. So Ford took a write down of just under $20 billion also because they scrapped some, you know, products that they just can't sell. And it's partly because infrastructure in the US, but also there's been a big change in US government policy on EVs. So the emission guidelines have changed. So therefore, there is far less pressure to actually buy EVs.
Another one for you, Tinika. NatWest is closing in on a deal in the region of £2.5 billion for one of Britain's biggest wealth managers, Evelyn Partners. Why does this deal rather make sense for NatWest?
Yeah, no. So this is an interesting one because this has been alleged to happen for a year now. So there's hopefully we hear later today. So NatWest, has finally sort of come out of quite a difficult period following the financial crisis. The government sold down their last bit of stake. So now it's back in growth mode. And what all UK banks have been really focused on since the financial crisis is to improve their profitability. So NatWest made it one of their priorities to improve their profitability. And you can either do that by doing your existing business better, but you can also buy a more profitable business. And wealth management, which is Evelyn's core business for affluent customers, is very profitable. It's not necessarily growing very much, but this is a business that they can link with their Coutts division, which is already mostly a private bank, but also has wealth management. So you can put these businesses together and really get some efficiencies and some cross-selling, no doubt.
Okay. Tinneke Fricke, Senior Fund Manager at W1M. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, the comeback of HMV continues with the entertainment retailer has reported a 7% rise in year-on-year sales in its latest results. Sales in the year-end of May 2025 rose by around £13 million to just over £200 million. Pre-tax profits were up 16%, but post-tax profits were flat. Managing Director Phil Halliday joins us now. Good morning, Phil.
Morning.
Phil, when post-tax profits are flat, does that just show how tough trading conditions must be right now?
Yeah, well, you can see, I mean, there's a bit of a sort of tax correction in there. So pre-tax profits would have been up slightly. But, you've got to do a lot of work on your top line to make any impact on your profit margin, which, illustrates the cost pressures that all businesses are facing at the moment and over the last couple of years.
Now, listen, we've only got the picture up until the end of May last year. So how have things been since then?
Yeah, really positive. I think we will see, when we get to the end of May this year, which will be the end of the financial year, we'll see a similar growth story. And we've been opening stores in Europe as well, which, would add further growth to this year's number. So pretty encouraging picture.
You saw footfalls up, demand for physical music is going strong. So what is bringing customers back? Is it that analog revival maybe?
I think it is that. We see strong demand for products across all our categories. So from trading cards through to books, we're selling a lot of Heated Rivalry at the moment. Right the way through to, the Olivia Dean albums flying off the shelves as well. So I think we've got, there is a physical media product for all age groups, I think. And once people sort of discover the store, they seem to stay with us for a while. So it means we are building up good momentum year on year with footfall, and that obviously translates to sales as well.
You mentioned you're expanding further into Europe. You have a new Amsterdam flagship too. Why does that growth opportunity look stronger than the UK right now?
Well, we've got 120 stores in the UK, so we're in most of the markets we would like to be in. But a lot of the products that we sell and the pop culture category particularly, but also the music, is very relevant to a European customer base. And we've opened the Amsterdam store will be our fourth store on mainland Europe, and we've got three in Ireland at the moment. And there's a strong demand for what we do out there. A lot of the franchises that we work with are very popular in Europe, whether it's a Netflix show or the Pokemon cards 30th anniversary this year, or some of the K-pop product we sell. There's a strong demand in Europe as well. So we've seen good sales in our European stores, and therefore, if you look across the continent, there's many more opportunities for us than there would be comparatively in the UK.
And it's not saying anything about UK high streets, is it?
Well, it's difficult on the high street in the UK. We used to have 200 and something stores, which was probably too many, but there's loads of places we would like to put stores. We'd keep opening them all day in the UK if we could. But it's true that there are fewer locations that can support the sales that you need to generate in order to cover your costs of opening a store. To an extent, that's true.
All right. Phil Halliday, Managing Director of HMV, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Leanna. 28 minutes past six. It's time for the sport. Here's Carthy. Morning.
Morning. Thank you very much. It was a dramatic day at the Winter Olympics and at the T20 World Cup cricket, and also in the Premier League. We've had the Super with Manchester City's 2-1 win over Liverpool, which in the context of the Premier League title race is a very big result, with second place City cutting Arsenal's lead to 6 points. The BBC's football correspondent John Murray has the details.
These two big modern rivals of the Premier League served up a remarkable finale to a match that as late as the 84th minute looked like it was going to be won by Liverpool, who led through a spectacular swerving free kick from Dominic Szoboszlai. Liverpool had been the better team in the second half, but City, needing to win to stay in touch with leaders Arsenal, hauled themselves level through Bernardo Silva and then uproariously in front through Haaland's penalty in the third minute of added time. And in an extraordinary climax, City had a third shirky goal ruled out because of a red card foul by Szoboszlai on Haaland as the ball rolled towards the goal, and which resulted in the sending off of the Liverpool man. But City's first win at Anfield for 5 years keeps them in the Premier League hunt.
Crystal Palace beat Brighton 1-0 and they move up into 13th place. Celtic will host Rangers in the Scottish Cup quarterfinals after Rangers put 8 goals past Queen's Park yesterday. And Manchester City are 8 points clear at the top of the Women's Super League. There was almost a huge shock involving England at the T20 Men's Cricket World Cup, with Nepal taking their match down to the final ball of the game. England just winning that opening match by 4 runs. Sam Curran, who defended 10 from the last over to deny Nepal the biggest win in their history, knows it was a scare for England.
I think fair play to Nepal. They were absolutely incredible in that chase all game. We win with the 2 points, but it just shows how competitive this World Cup's going to be. We saw yesterday as well with a couple of the smaller nations nearly taking down India, the Pakistan, stuff like that. So it's pretty nerves there, but we got it done.
Ireland lost their opening game against Sri Lanka, winning by 20 runs. And Scotland are in action right now in Kolkata against Italy, and they have just lost a wicket. So it's 126 for one of 13.5 overs there in Kolkata. We'll keep you up to date with that match. 5 gold medals are on offer at the Winter Olympics today. Great Britain's Kirsty Muir has reached the freestyle skiing women's slopestyle final. 19-year-old snowboarder Mia Brooks has qualified for the big air final this evening. The big story from the weekend at the Winter Olympics was that awful crash in the women's downhill by one of the all-time greats of skiing, the 2010 Olympic champion Lindsey Vonn. She was airlifted to hospital and she has already had surgery on her broken left leg. The 41-year-old was competing in her 5th Olympics just 9 days after rupturing ligaments in her left knee. In the next hour, we'll be looking at the opening weekend of the men's Six Nations. And in the last few hours, the Seattle Seahawks even beat the New England Patriots 29-13 to claim their second Super Bowl victory. Plenty of celebs at the Super Bowl. We also had Novak Djokovic at the figure skating last night, and Madonna, yes, Madonna, was at the Women's Super League game between Chelsea and Spurs.
Yeah, her daughters play for Spurs.
Two of her daughters play for the under-14s team. That was the day before that match, but she came back to watch Spurs again.
Wonderful. There we are. Bad choice of team, Carthy. Sorry to Spurs fans listening.
Skis cutting through snow at breathtaking speed. Snowboards spinning in ways never seen before. Skeleton sleds pushing the limits. Making history, breaking records, and taking home gold. Trails will blaze. The Winter Olympics. Watch live on BBC iPlayer.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster. It's 28 minutes to 7, time for a summary of the news with Tom Sanders.
Sir Keir Starmer will address Labour MPs today in a bid to secure their support, which has been threatened by the scandal surrounding Lord Mandelson. The Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney, resigned yesterday, saying he took full responsibility for advising Sir Keir to appoint the peer as the UK's ambassador to Washington. There's been criticism from some Labour MPs who say the final decision was taken by the Prime Minister and that he should be held accountable. Others have warned against a change in leadership. The pro-democracy media tycoon Jimmy Lai has been sentenced to 20 years in prison by a court in Hong Kong. The 78-year-old British citizen was found guilty in December on charges of foreign collusion and sedition under the strict national security law imposed by Beijing. Rights groups have condemned the 20-year term as a death sentence. The Prince of Wales will begin his first official trip to Saudi Arabia today. The 3-day visit will focus on trade, energy and young people. Ministers view the diplomatic relationship with the Gulf state as strategically important, despite concerns about the kingdom's human rights record. A group of MPs has warned that hundreds of thousands of social homes in England fail to meet basic standards. The report from the Housing, Communities and Local Government Committee says many residents do not have their complaints taken seriously and repairs are slow. The government said it was taking action to drive up the quality of social housing. Stocks in Japan have risen to record levels after the Prime Minister, Sanae Takaichi, won a landslide election victory. Her Liberal Democratic Party won more than two-thirds of the seats in the lower parliament, marking its best ever result. The man convicted of shooting 51 people dead at mosques in New Zealand 7 years ago has begun an appeal against his conviction and sentence. Brenton Tarrant is serving life without parole, but now says he was incapable of making decisions when he admitted his guilt because of the conditions inside prison.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's 26 minutes to seven. What now then for the Prime Minister after his Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney, resigned yesterday? His next step, immediate next step, is keeping his own MPs on side. He is due to address the PLP, the Parliamentary Labour Party, this evening. Henry Zeffman is our Chief Political Correspondent. Morning, Henry.
Good morning, Anna.
At moments like this, your phone is running white hot. So I suppose the first thing to ask is, what more do we know, or what more have you learned about why Morgan McSweeney left?
Well, there were warm words flowing in both directions in the statements from Morgan McSweeney and from Sir Keir Starmer yesterday, Anna. But speaking to the many people, and they are many, still in government and in the Labour Party who feel fiercely loyal to Morgan McSweeney, it feels that for them, this is not quite as amicable a divorce as those statements made it sound. Let me just give you some of the words being thrown around by allies of Morgan McSweeney to describe the Prime Minister's willingness to part with him. Pointless, ridiculous, cowardly. And I've even spoken to someone questioning the extent to which the Prime Minister took the decision. There were discussions between the two of them late last week and over the weekend about what should happen. Well, one supporter of Morgan McSweeney claimed to me that Keir Starmer was just not coming to a conclusive decision either way. And so ultimately, Morgan McSweeney took it into his own hands and decided to go. There are also those questioning where Morgan McSweeney's argument, essentially that championing Peter Mandelson's appointment is a sacking offence, leaves others in Downing Street, with a particular focus on Jonathan Powell, the National Security Advisor, who people in Downing Street claim also was pushing the appointment of his old colleague. Well, the co-acting chiefs of staff are now Vidya Alexson and Jill Cuthbertson. They had been Morgan McSweeney's deputies. There are suggestions from some around government late last night that Keir Starmer had hoped that the former civil servant Louise Casey might step into the breach. We'll see where things land permanently. And just remember, we still have never seen a version of Keir Starmer in his almost 6 years as leader of the Labour Party without Morgan McSweeney at his side.
One of the great problems for Number 10, Henry, is when these stories go on and on and on in some kind of doom loop. So the Prime Minister will want to try and draw a line under this. He'll want to try and move on. How could he do that?
Well, he's not likely to appear in public today, but instead he's addressing two audiences which are probably more important for him in the very immediate term to shore up his premiership. And that is Labour MPs at a meeting of the Parliamentary Labour Party, as you mentioned, and also Number 10 staff. I'm told that MPs can expect to hear an argument that Keir Starmer also made privately to a group of MPs at Chequers on Thursday, where he told them he was as angry and as frustrated as you are, because all of us came into politics to make a difference to people's lives. And he'll argue that Peter Mandelson's behaviour is corrosive to that principle. Over the coming days, I think we can expect specifics as well as rhetoric. I understand that last week the Prime Minister tasked his team with working up changes to strengthen the appointments process, and that will include changes to some of the vetting issues alluded to by Morgan McSweeney in his resignation letter, and also strengthening rules around lobbying. I'm told some of those options for reforms were presented to the Prime Minister last night, so we are now likely to hear more about what he wants to do this week. I mean, what the Prime Minister has to say about how to reform politics in general now becomes, I think, a massive part, Anna, of his battle to stay in his job. I mean, somebody who's seen this government right up close said to me yesterday, this feels like the middle of the end. And I think Sir Keir Starmer's challenge today is to find a way to make it feel like a new beginning.
Henry Zeffman, our Chief Political Correspondent, thank you. So we will hear from various Labour MPs during the programme this morning. We'll hear from Kemi Badenoch, the Leader of the Opposition, at 10 to 8. And then at 10 past 8 this morning, the voice speaking for the government today, the Minister, the Labour veteran, Baroness Smith, will be with us.
At 28 minutes to 7, let's turn to sport. Last night's Super Bowl. Well, actually, it wasn't really about sport for many people. Although the Seattle Seahawks beat the New England Patriots, What mattered to many people watching was the music, the culture and, yes, the politics. Donald Trump took on the man chosen to deliver the halftime entertainment. The world's most played artist, Grammy Award winner, Puerto Rican Benito Antonio Martinez Ocasio, or Bad Bunny, as he is known to his hundreds of millions of fans. Our North America correspondent Peter Bowes explains.
All eyes were on the halftime show to see what the main star, the Grammy-winning Puerto Rican rapper Bad Bunny, had in store. Much anticipation after last week at the Grammys, he said ICE out ahead of his acceptance speech, a reference to the immigration and customs agents posted in cities controversially around this country. He was always a controversial choice for the Super Bowl, so much so that conservative groups organised an alternative halftime entertainment show framed as patriotic, family-friendly and values-oriented. More country music than Spanish language pop. But at the end of the day, Nick, Bad Bunny's Super Bowl performance was less controversial than his Grammys appearance. It started with him emerging from a sugarcane field in the middle of the stadium, a high-energy, very colourful performance, almost all in Spanish, with guest appearances by Ricky Martin and Lady Gaga. I did hear Bad Bunny at one stage say in English, "God bless America," and at one point he handed what looked like a replica of his Grammy Award to a child and said, "Always believe in yourself." His final song was DTMF, which is the title track from his album last year, which is a love letter to Puerto Rico. And then right at the end, he held up a football with the words, "Together we are America," written on it.
And I suspect, Peter, that Donald Trump hated every single aspect of it.
He was certainly watching. He made that very clear. And he's been opposed to Bad Bunny ever since it was announced that he would be the halftime performer, which he said was a terrible choice. But he was watching. He posted on Truth Social saying that the halftime show was absolutely terrible, one of the worst ever, that it was an affront to the greatness of America. He went on, "Nobody understands a word this guy is saying, and the dancing is disgusting." He said, "There is nothing inspirational about this halftime show."
Politics follows football.
Politics follows football as ever in this country to some extent. Everything seems to be, even entertainment events these days, tinged by the political reality of what's going on around us.
Peter Bowes, our North America correspondent, thank you.
It's 19 minutes to seven. The heads of some of the world's biggest social media companies will be giving evidence in court for the first time as their platforms are accused of harming children by pushing inappropriate content through powerful algorithms that don't consider the ultimate result on a young user's mental health. Lily Jamali is our North America technology correspondent and tell me more about this case.
This one is significant, first of all, just for the fact that it's going to trial at all. The social media companies have been able to successfully argue that cases like this shouldn't advance to this point where they'd be heard by a jury at trial, because in their view, they're not responsible for the content that people post to their platforms. The reason this case has been able to advance is because the argument being made by the plaintiffs is that it's actually the way that these platforms are designed by the remaining defendants that is really a problem, that is creating addictive behavior. And the defendants that are left are Meta Platforms, which runs Instagram, and YouTube, which is a subsidiary of Google's parent Alphabet. We should note just in the last few weeks, Snapchat has settled this very same case, and TikTok, just in the run-up to the very first day of trial when they were supposed to start selecting a jury, they settled that morning.
And at the center of this are personal stories of individuals and this one individual who says that social media had a detrimental effect on her mental health.
That's exactly right. This is a now 20-year-old woman from Northern California. She's being referred to by her initials in this case as KGM. And hers is one of many cases like this, but she's going to say at trial that she has been addicted since she started using these platforms at the age of 8. And so some of the issues that she has described include depression, difficulty sleeping, And, you know, a lot of the time we hear about suicidal thoughts and things like that as well associated with social media addiction. And you think about, you know, an 8-year-old being on social media. I've had people ask me, you know, why did her parents allow her on these platforms back then? And I think about how much our understanding of social media and both the benefits, but also the significant drawbacks have become known to us over these last 12 years. So I think her parents were not alone in allowing their daughter onto these platforms at such a young age. And I can tell you that I do expect that, you know, the companies that are still in this case will probably try to pick apart her character.
Lily, if we look into the future, what kind of impact could this trial have?
That is such a great question. And it is hard to know. But what I do think about is the wave of actions that are taking place all around the world. Australia deciding to ban social media for people under the age of 16, just in December that law was enacted. And other countries are following suit. We're seeing these ideas either being implemented or discussed in the UK, in Spain, in Norway, and so many other countries. It really feels like there is a wave of pushback against these companies, and that pushback is coming from the government, from that level. Up until now, a lot of the time, these social media platforms have said, you know, it's the parents' fault. It's the families that aren't taking responsibility. But when you get governments involved, they have to sort of act a little bit differently, take these issues a lot more seriously. And I think pushing responsibility onto parents is no longer going to fly.
Lily Jamali, thank you.
Time now, 7:15. Dozens of flood warnings and alerts have been issued across the country following days of rain, particularly in the southwest of England and parts of Wales. Some have had more rain in the first few days of February than they would expect in the entire month. Amongst those suffering is James Winslade, a beef and arable farmer in Somerset, who joins us on the line. Good morning to you,
morning.
James. I'm looking at a photograph of your farm. I say a farm. To me, it looks more like a sea with the odd hedge and building visible. You are surrounded by water, aren't you?
We are, yeah. We have a seaside view. It's worth a fortune if anybody wants to buy it. Yeah, we've been inundated. We were inundated in 2014, and the Somerset Rivers Authority was set up by Owen Paterson to get enough money to maintain the rivers, because if they were silted up 52%. Since then, we would be in a lot worse situation if the SRA and the Internal Drainage Board hadn't done and carried on maintenance on the rivers. So we're thankful for that, which has increased the flow. But we are very reliant here on the Environment Agency putting pumps. We have pumps in the area to pump water off, which have been there for many, many years. You know, I'm third generation farmer here.
Yeah, to that extent, you're used to the problem, but you're concerned that it's not being dealt with properly.
Yeah, well, not to this extent. We're used to the problem. We are on the Somerset levels. We will take water, and moors are designed, certain aspect parts of the moors are designed to take water, and then the water will drop away, mm-hmm. get pumped out. And it's sort of a fluid situation through the winter.
Just give us a picture for
to this extent.
Yeah, and give us a picture of how bad it is, James, because I can see the photograph, our listeners can't. What percentage of your farm is actually now underwater?
About 92% of the farm.
So it's pretty much all the crops, is it?
Yeah, we are self-sufficient. We're beef and arable, so all the arable we grow feed back to the cattle.
And the cattle are where?
They're all in the buildings on one of the little islands that you see in the picture there.
Yeah.
You know, this is a special site of scientific interest. We farm with nature as well. Everything we have is, you know, we are self-sufficient. So you look at all the, we've got barn owl boxes around the farm. They're very territorial. All the field mice and all of their prey have drowned, basically.
Yeah.
We have badger sets on the farm, you know. We have all sorts of wonderful animals and wildlife here. But and
given
plants.
Your years of knowledge, James, you look at this and think, well, you know, we'll get through, we'll get past this, or are there days in which you think, enough, we can't go on like
this? It is getting more so with global warming and the experts saying we're going to have wetter winters. Surely as a nation, it's not just here that's being affected by floods. We aren't having enough investment put into infrastructure to get this water away. The Environment Agency announced late summer that they are walking away from all routine maintenance nationwide. Well, if that happens, we're going to be in a lot worse position. People say, why do we live on the Somerset Levels? Well, we're three generations. There's a major town of Bridgewater, Hinkley Point, and New Gravitas, which is the new battery centre, down at Bridgewater. It's all got to go through Bridgewater to get out to sea.
Well, look, we wish you luck, James. James Winslow there, beef and arable farmer in Somerset. Incidentally, the Environment Agency say they've got teams on the ground to reduce the impact. And they encourage people, as we do, always check your flood risk.
It's 11 minutes to 7. Japan's Prime Minister has won a decisive victory in a snap election that was called to endorse her leadership. Sanae Takeuchi is being congratulated by fellow world leaders. And now she can deliver on her conservative agenda. Campaign priorities like the economy, tax and tighter rules on immigration. Well, John Nilsson Wright is Professor of Japanese Politics at the University of Cambridge. Good morning.
Good morning.
Before we talk about what she's going to do, let's talk about the mechanism by which she can do it, because she's got a super majority, which is something a bit special.
She has. And I mean, it's an extraordinary result when you consider how her party, the Liberal Democratic Party, was doing badly last year. This is very much, I think, a personal endorsement of her. But the numbers she now has in the lower house of the Japanese parliament, the more powerful of the two chambers, means that she can really set the legislative agenda. Her party will now command all the key committees, the chairmanship of those committees, and she has the numbers to override any opposition from the upper house, which is controlled by the opposition parties, simply through sheer weight of political numbers.
What's the balance between personality and policy? Because obviously she's drawn people in with her personal style, but what about the messages that she's been sending about what she's going to do now?
I think a lot of this comes down to Takeuchi's sort of representation of a new style of politics. She's a plain speaker. Her gender has not hurt her. Younger voters, I think, have warmed to the idea of someone at the helm of Japanese politics who's very unconventional. And, you know, a former heavy metal drummer. She's displayed some of that heritage of hers in her diplomacy with neighboring countries, with South Korea, for example, playing the drums alongside President Lee. But at the same time, she's also comes from a wing of the party, which is more to the right, that is very much intent on emphasizing the importance of strong defense. We saw another shift in Japanese politics last year with the breakthrough of a populist party. And Takeuchi was successful in winning the leadership of the LDP, primarily because her own party members were concerned that the party would be eclipsed on the right. So a strong defense, building up the military, focusing on the threats from Japan's neighbors, most obviously China, where the prime minister has had some tension in recent months, particularly over the status of Taiwan. And the electorate would like to see, I think, strength and stability, and that's what she represents very much.
Mm. Just a brief thought, John. Are there any challenges lurking? Because it all looks very positive just now. What problems might she face?
Well, I think the economy is probably the most obvious one. Japan has been going through a cost of living crisis. The prime minister has committed herself to look at the possibility of cutting tax on food, reducing the consumption tax for a period of maybe 2 years or so. The big question is, how will she pay for that? It's going to cost about $32 billion. And the markets are concerned that this sort of expansive fiscal policy will put a huge strain on the country's finances. Japan, with a national debt of 230% of GDP, obviously can't afford to take on more big expenses. The Prime Minister has indicated she will look at this issue, but she's been cautious, which I think is a reflection of some of those fiscal challenges she faces. And of course, the big issue, the one that all countries face, is the relationship with the United States and handling her relationship with Donald Trump. She will meet him in March. This will be a visit to the White House. And of course, President Trump came out before the election and endorsed her. So that's a sign of a strong relationship, and she's handled it well. But the big fundamental issues about economic relations and guaranteeing that the United States will remain a reliable ally is a key issue for her.
John Nielsen Wright, Professor of Japanese Politics at the University of Cambridge. Thank you.
7 minutes to seven now. What now? What next? That's the question on The Morning After. The man who made Keir Starmer, and on whom the Prime Minister has depended for so long, quit his job. Chief of Staff Morgan McSweeney is out of Downing Street. The question many Labour MPs are asking is whether his boss should follow him. Let's talk to Andy MacDonald, who's been a critic of the regime, I suspect you would call it, running Downing Street. The Labour MP for Middlesbrough and Thornaby East joins us on the line. Is that right? Do you believe that Mr McSweeney going will make a difference, Mr MacDonald?
Well, I don't think getting rid of one or two individuals, be it Mandelson or McSweeney, addresses the fundamental problem at the heart of the Labour Party. There's a cultural reset and a return to pluralism and inclusion. We've pursued this Mandelsonian agenda for some years now, and look where it's landed us.
When you say a cultural reset, do you mean that the party should move back towards the left? You serve Jeremy Corbyn in his shadow cabinet. Is that what you want to see?
I want to see this purge and scourge of the left come to an end, and the war be declared as over, because it has caused us so much pain and harm, and it's diluted who we are as a Labour Party.
What would that mean to listeners who are not members of the Labour Party or not activists? So the purge of the left is over. What does that mean for the policies? You are, after all, in government, not in opposition, that this government might present.
Absolutely right. Well, let's just look at some of the things that we've been talking about over the last several months. The fact that, you know, we campaigned in opposition to lift the two-child cap. We did the same over WASPI. It's about serving the working people of this country, not imposing a removal of the wind fuel allowance only for it to be reversed, and then punching down on the poorest and the most vulnerable in our society with proposed welfare cuts and having to return on them. We really do need more of a clear signpost and not a weather vane, but we need to hear the debate amongst the whole broad swathe of the Labour Party, not just a narrow faction.
Do you believe that Keir Starmer is the man who can do that?
Well, we're going to hear, does he accept that? But if he comes tonight and simply says that, you know, Peter Mandelson was horrible and he's very nasty, and I made a mistake to believe what he said, and we move on and we just revert to, it's okay, crisis averted, we carry on as we are, that's not going to cut it, because everybody in the PLP knows that it's much deeper than that.
And therefore, at that point, if that is the message from the Prime Minister tonight, you contemplate a change of leader, a change of Prime Minister?
It's in his hands. If he doesn't own the error he's made and recognise the problem in front of him and articulate it and tell us how he's going to deal with it, then I'm afraid it is coming to an end, if not than today, but certainly in the weeks and months ahead. But he's got to convince the PLP tonight that he's got it and a change is necessary. And the change that he promoted was no other than to purge the left, and it's got us in this terrible mess that we're in now.
A change, in summary, Mr. MacDonald, to what and to whom?
To a more pluralist, democratic socialist agenda. Let's, you know, push
but
out.
If I'm a voter, I want to know who my prime minister is. I don't want to know about, forgive me, pluralism, inclusion. This is political jargon. Who's going to run the country? What are they going to do is what I want to know.
The moral base and the principles that we adhere to in government are important to everybody in the country. And it's not just about personalities. It's about the things that we do and the things that we stand for. That's what's got to be communicated through this process.
So give us one policy and maybe one potential new leader.
Well, we could look to the whole raft of things that we said in previous manifestos opposite the water industry, for example. Look how
nationalised water, and who would do that? Is Angela Rayner the woman to do that?
Well, as and when there's a vacancy, I'll see what people have to say. But if we're going to just continue with this line of outsourcing and privatisation, for example, in the health service, and embrace another round of PFI.
I'm going to rush you, Mr. MacDonald, because we're a bit short of time. But we'll get you back on when you want to tell us some names. Yeah, thank you for that. Andy MacDonald there, Labour MP, Middlesbrough and Thornaby East.
Here is Johnny Diamond with a word about his new series starting tonight.
How did we get here? Israel and the Palestinians. on BBC Radio 4. A new series unpacking the complicated and contested backstory of the Middle East conflict. I'm Johnny Diamond, and with the help of some expert guests, we'll be travelling through the centuries and hearing about the people and events in an attempt to understand the past that has brought us to such a present. That's How Did We Get Here? Israel and the Palestinians, starting tonight at 8 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
It is wet, but Sarah Keith Lucas can tell us more.
It is, absolutely, Nick. Good morning. Yes, we'll start with southwest England and south Wales, where we are expecting a few showers around first thing, but more persistent rain into the afternoon. There's going to be a yellow rain warning in force once again. The winds are going to pick up too. It is going to be mild at around 10 or 11 degrees. Into southeast England, the Midlands and eastern England, cloudy, drizzly, some mist and murk around. But as the day progresses, we'll see some brighter spells developing. A little bit of sunshine later, 11 or 12 degrees here. But for North Wales, into northern England and across all of Scotland, low cloud, drizzle around, some fog across the east of Scotland too. There's some heavy showers this morning. They'll be coming and going. By the afternoon, fewer showers, some brighter spells, particularly across the north of Scotland. But towards the Northern Isles, it stays breezy all day with a brisk southeasterly wind. 8 to 10 degrees the top temperature here. Northern Ireland, fog, then bright spells with cloud and rain developing into the afternoon. Still mild, though, at around 8 or 9 degrees.
Thank you, Sarah. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Monday, the 9th of February. The headlines this morning: Sir Keir Starmer will seek to convince his Labour critics that he should remain as Prime Minister when he addresses a meeting of the Labour Parliamentary Party. We'll hear from the Leader of the Opposition, Kemi Badenoch, and from the senior Labour backbencher, Emily Thornberry, before 8 o'clock. Human rights groups have denounced the 20-year prison sentence handed down in Hong Kong to the British pro-democracy campaigner Jimmy Lai. And Prince William is to begin his first official visit to Saudi Arabia as part of government efforts to strengthen ties with the kingdom.
Also in this hour of the programme, Bad Bunny, the Puerto Rican music star, led a celebratory performance of Latino heritage at the Super Bowl halftime show. We'll look at how that huge sporting event became a focus for America's new culture war around immigration.
In that proud celebration and in that unapologetic presentation of the music, there's a political message, which is that, you know, Puerto Ricans and Latin Americans are not going to be cowed.
And the poet Wendy Cope picks the book that ignited and continues to fuel her love of reading.
What's enchanting about the Pooh books is the characters. The characters are so funny and interesting, and there's a lot of kindness and love in this book. Pooh is a really nice chap.
Certainly is. The BBC News this morning is read by Tom Sanders.
Sir Keir Starmer will address Labour MPs today as he fights to shore up his leadership, which has been threatened by the scandal surrounding Lord Mandelson. The Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney, resigned yesterday, saying he took full responsibility for advising Sir Keir to appoint the peer as the UK's ambassador to Washington. Here's our political correspondent, Ian Watson.
When he addresses his restless MPs tonight, Sir Keir Starmer will know that potential leadership challengers will be in the audience. But as there's no one clear successor, that might mean that he'll have an opportunity to regain the political initiative. Some of his MPs are wary of a leadership contest because they believe the government can't survive another period of introspection and infighting. Others are just worried their favoured candidate might not win. But the questions about the Prime Minister's judgment predate the latest Epstein revelations. And there are a significant number of his colleagues who use phrases about his leadership, such as drinking in the last chance saloon, last throw of the dice, and even the final reset. And while the loss of Morgan McSweeney could facilitate that reset, some of the former Chief of Staff's allies are now suggesting other heads should be ruling over the Mandelson affair. With a difficult by-election this month and crucial elections in May, Morgan McSweeney's departure hasn't bought Sir Keir job security.
A court in Hong Kong has sentenced the pro-democracy campaigner Jimmy Lai to 20 years in prison. The media tycoon, who's a British citizen, was convicted in December on charges of foreign collusion and sedition. Responding to the sentence, the Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper said the government would rapidly engage further on Mr. Lai's case. Martin Yip sent this report from outside the court.
This is the harshest punishment yet handed out under Hong Kong's strict national security law, which was imposed by China in 2020 in response to large and sometimes violent pro-democracy protests. Jimmy Lai nodded as the judge announced his sentence, while his wife and former reporters from his now-defunct Apple Daily newspaper burst into tears. Rights groups have condemned the 20-year term, calling it effectively a death sentence for the 78-year-old and a grave injustice. Mr. Lai's family described it as draconian and cruel. Last month, Sir Keir Starmer raised Jimmy Lai's case with China's President Xi Jinping when the two leaders met in Beijing. The Prime Minister previously said that securing his release was a priority for his government. Jimmy Lai has always denied the charges against him, saying he had advocated for what he believed were Hong Kong's values, including the rule of law and free speech.
The Prince of Wales will begin his first official trip to Saudi Arabia today. The three-day visit will focus on trade, energy and young people. Our senior royal correspondent Daniela Ralph reports from Riyadh.
After a week in which the royal family have been under intense scrutiny as a result of the Epstein files, the Prince of Wales's visit to Saudi Arabia is an attempt to return to business as usual, if that is possible. He'll be in the country for 3 days at the request of the UK government, who view it as their most strategically important relationship in the region. Forging stronger ties with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman will be a priority for Prince William. Saudi Arabia is modernising culturally and economically, but remains an authoritarian regime ruled by an absolute monarchy where political protesters are severely sanctioned. Sources close to William say despite the diplomatic sensitivities, he understands his role as future king is to support the government's work and didn't flinch when asked to go to Saudi Arabia.
MPs have criticised the standard of social housing in England, saying hundreds of thousands of homes fail to meet basic standards. Members of the Commons Housing Communities and Local Government Committee say they're also concerned that a new decent homes standard won't be brought in for another decade. The government says it's taking action to drive up the quality of social housing. Tara Welsh has more details.
Today's report says too many people are still suffering with appalling housing and don't have their complaints treated seriously. Conditions are generally better in homes rented by councils and housing associations than the private sector, but the MPs say 430,000 social homes fail to meet basic standards. Last month, the government published a new decent homes standard for the rental sector, but landlords won't have to comply until 2035. Ministers say they're encouraging them to raise standards sooner. Housing associations say they've invested a record £10 billion maintaining and improving homes last year.
Japan's main stock index soared by more than 5% in early trading after the country's first female Prime Minister, Sanae Takaichi, secured a resounding election victory. It's the first time the Nikkei has climbed above 57,000 points. The coalition, led by Ms. Takaichi's Liberal Democrat Party, won more than two-thirds of the seats in the lower house of parliament, paving the way for higher fiscal spending and a massive tax cut. A white supremacist who shot dead 51 people at two mosques in New Zealand has appeared in court in Wellington to try to withdraw his guilty plea. Brenton Tarrant is serving a whole life sentence after the attack on worshippers during Friday prayers in Christchurch in 2019. Our correspondent Katie Watson reports.
It was in March 2020, a year after the attack, that Brenton Tarrant pleaded guilty to carrying out the deadliest mass shooting in modern-day New Zealand. This week's hearing seeks to withdraw that guilty plea and appeal against his sentence. The crux of his argument is that he wasn't able to make rational decisions because of what he has described as torturous and inhumane prison conditions. Local media reports say he told the Court of Appeals via a video link that if he had been given another option to pleading guilty, he would have taken it. If Tarrant is allowed to withdraw his guilty plea, the case would potentially go to trial on all charges. If he's not allowed to retract his plea, there'll be another hearing later in the year to consider his appeal against his sentence.
Universities have been told to report threats of foreign interference directly to the government and security services. MI5 and the National Cyber Security Centre have given a rare briefing to more than 70 university leaders about how to recognise and resist attempts to manipulate their work. Here's our education reporter, Vanessa Clark.
The Skills Minister, Jackie Smith, says British universities have become a prime target for foreign states and hostile actors. And the recent security briefing comes after staff at Sheffield Hallam University in China were threatened and intimidated for 2 years in an attempt to shut down research into alleged human rights abuses. The sophisticated methods used to influence staff and students were explained to university vice-chancellors by the experts, including the use of professional networking sites and financial incentives. The government is opening a new direct reporting route between universities and the security services so threats of academic interference can be acted on more quickly. The chief executive of the Russell Group of Leading Universities, Dr. Tim Bradshaw, said it would empower institutions to report concerns and take action more confidently.
American football's showpiece event, the Super Bowl, has been won by the Seattle Seahawks. They beat the New England Patriots by 29 points to 13 at Levi's Stadium in California. The halftime show by the Puerto Rican artist Bad Bunny has been criticised by Donald Trump as one of the worst ever, after it was performed almost entirely in Spanish. Writing on social media, the US president claimed, "Nobody understands a word this guy is saying."
Tom, thank you very much indeed. It's 9 minutes past seven now. Say the name Morgan McSweeney to most people in the high streets, pubs and offices of the UK, before yesterday at least, and there's a good chance that you would get a blank look. But despite him not being a household name outside the Westminster bubble, the resignation of the Prime Minister's most powerful adviser will have a huge impact everywhere, not least for Keir Starmer, who now has to keep his own MPs on side to save his job and to forge a political path forward without the man described as the architect of both his leadership campaign and Labour's landslide 2024 general election win. So what next for the Prime Minister and his job? Well, Emily Thornbury joins us, the MP for Islington South and Finsbury and the chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. Good morning.
Good morning.
I know you heard Andy MacDonald, fellow Labour MP, just before the news, using some choice phrases. He was talking about the fact that the Prime Minister will talk to backbench Labour MPs tonight. If he doesn't own the error, it is coming to an end. I think he's the closest that Andy MacDonald came to saying he should go. He didn't say it as clearly as that, but that was the closest. What do you think?
Where shall I start? I mean, I think the first thing I want to say is that I'm glad to see that the person who was the architect of Peter Mandelson's appointment has taken responsibility and has gone. And I think that's important to say. And I think that it's also important to say that Morgan had become quite a divisive figure. But the one thing, well, there were a couple of things that everybody agreed on. One was that he is brilliant. But I think the other thing was people felt that he was in the wrong job. And so I think it's right that he's gone, and I think it is an opportunity. And I think the first thing really is when we meet at 6 o'clock this evening, the first question will be, will we be in Committee Room 14? Because there's not a lot of room in there. I mean, it's the biggest room in the palace, but there are so many of us. And I think that's the first thing we should remember. You know, Morgan delivered a brilliant election strategy, but the people delivered us the votes and elected us and gave us a big majority. And we've got a job to do. And what we need to do is work together. This is an opportunity for us to be united and to remember who we are as a party and what it is that we should be doing. We should be going for growth in the economy. We should be going for greater equality, greater fairness. We should be a party that where our leader allows our country to hold its head up high in the world. You know, that is the kind, and it's really hard because we inherited the most appalling mess. I mean, highest amount of debt, highest taxes, and public services on their knees. Not exactly an easy inheritance.
So at this stage, you're supporting the Prime Minister. But as you said there, Morgan McSweeney gave the advice, but ultimately the decision to appoint Peter Mandelson belonged to Sir Keir Starmer. It was his decision, as Andy MacDonald was saying. He has to own that. And many people will say that he has not sufficiently owned that.
Well, I mean, I undoubtedly it was a mistake. And I think that, again, I think sometimes what isn't immediately obvious, because we do our best to try and cover it up, is that politics is a team sport. I mean, I am 10 times the woman I really am because of my staff, because of the advice that I'm given, because of the work that they do. I do front of house and I rely on people to give me advice.
But the Prime Minister
knew. And if I'm given wrong advice...
The Prime Minister knew that he had maintained a relationship with a convicted sex offender. He knew that detail. That was key.
Yeah, I know. And what we're going to need to see when the papers come out is just how much detail he was given. I mean, for example, I mean, I know it was in the FT, but frankly, I didn't notice that he had gone to stay in Epstein's house after Epstein had been convicted and was in prison. I mean, that takes it into a completely different realm. I think that the decision to appoint Peter Mandelson was one that was rushed. There was the announcement of the appointment, and then they did the and then they did the vetting afterwards. That is a very unusual way of doing things.
So all of these damning things, how can the Prime Minister then continue to defend his position in the face of making that appointment?
I think that the one thing that, again, that everybody agrees with, not just in the Labour Party, but I think across the country, is that there is one thing that is an absolute truth about Keir, is that he's a decent man. And, you know, but only human.
But
and
is he a good made, leader?
No, I'm just, wait a minute. So the first question is he a decent man? You know, would he make that decision? If he had sat down and thought about it carefully, would he really have made that decision?
But he did make the decision.
I know. And he needs to have advisers who reflect, you know, on the sorts of the way in which where he wants to take the party and how he wants to take the party there and reflect the values that he has. And I think that he is. I don't think that it was right for him to deliver the speech that he did on immigration. And I think he regrets that, too. I mean, it's not like he hasn't made mistakes, but, you know, guess what? He's a human being. But you do need to have, if you have advisers who are giving you wrong advice, you have to get new advisers. That is your responsibility.
Is he a good leader?
He's a good leader in that he is strong and clear. I think that he needs to step up a bit more than he has. I think that we do need, first of all, I think on the one hand, we as a party need to be pretty united, right? From the leaflet deliverer to the cabinet member, we need to be united and we need to know where we're going and we need to stick together. But we do need to have a clear leadership, and that's his challenge. So we reset and he needs to reset as well.
There is more to come on this story. This is not the end, because there's a huge tranche of documents coming, communications, all sorts of things that happened between ministers, Labour MPs, people in Downing Street, while Peter Mandelson was ambassador to the US, which could be even more damaging than what we've seen already. What are your thoughts on that? And particularly on what we get to see, because there's this balance of transparency versus national security and international relations as well.
I think the first thing is nothing can be more damaging than what we have heard about the way that Peter Mandelson was behaving and his relationship with Epstein and the things that we've heard about what Epstein was doing to those young girls. I mean, there's nothing more damaging than that. I think that what we may have in the next few months is snippets of gossip and things that will be personally profoundly embarrassing. And I'm sure that the media will love it. but I don't know.
This is important, though. This is the thing. It's pulling back the curtain to the sort of thing that we should know.
I mean, I think there's a lot of the currency of politics is gossip. And I think you will get a lot of that. But I think that what will be excluded, I hope, scrupulously, is things that will affect national security and international relations. I mean, the last thing we want is more, you know, poor old Kim Darroch, who thought as ambassador he was writing a private memo, and indeed he was, but somebody leaked it. Imagine how much more indiscreet people might be in WhatsApp messages and emails. We all gossip.
We'll wait and see. As you say, in the next few months, we'll find out. I'm sure Emily Thornberry, thank you for coming in this morning.
7:16, we're going to be hearing from the Minister Baroness Jackie Smith later in the programme. But let's reflect more on those documents that are going to be released. Secret memos, documents, emails, all being released to a Commons inquiry into the appointment of Peter Mandelson as ambassador to the United States. And the release of them is worrying not just ministers, advisers, Labour MPs, but many diplomats, people who have been in the business of giving secret, confidential advice to ministers about what they think is happening in other countries. One who knows this problem well is Lord Ricketts, Peter Ricketts, former diplomat, former head of the Foreign Office, indeed, who joins us on the line. Morning to you, Lord Ricketts. Are you worried about what's being released?
Yes, I think this could be collateral damage to Britain's diplomatic effectiveness around the world. I mean, first of all, I absolutely support the need to get out into public as soon as possible all the documents related to the appointment of Peter Mandelson, what the vetting process was, what the due diligence was, what people were saying to each other. That's absolutely fair. But the requirement on the government, as it's come from the intelligence and Security Committee is far wider than that. It talks about, I quote, electronic communications between Lord Mandelson and ministers, government officials and special advisers during his time as ambassador. Now, that seems to me to put into scope the whole swathe of diplomatic reporting from the embassy in Washington over those 7 months.
So what's the worst-case scenario, Lord Ricketts? It's that Mandelson or somebody to Mandelson has written something pretty rude about, say, Donald Trump or another key official in the United States, and that ends up being published.
Well, all that material, all the diplomatic telegrams are signed off by the ambassador, so they're all electronic communications with the government. And the government has the right to put to the Intelligence and Security Committee things that they think are problematic for national security or international relations. But it's then for the committee to decide. And I think that can only have a chilling effect on willingness of people across America to talk frankly to British diplomats if they think the material could land up in public. But more widely than that, around the world, I mean, political dissidents, political activists are talking to British diplomats because they know we're highly professional, that their confidence will be kept discreet. But then they see in London a huge tranche of diplomatic documents being handed over to a parliamentary committee. I'm sure the committee will take their responsibilities very seriously, but that alone will, I think, make people more reluctant to talk to British embassies. They can't be sure where the documents might land up one day.
People not in your world, Lord Ricketts, may assume that these documents are written in diplomatic language by diplomats, but I'm just looking back at what was revealed in the documents that we were just hearing about from Emily Thornberry. Kim Darroch, who was the ambassador, obviously didn't expect any of this to get out in public, and he described the first Trump administration as inept and insecure. It's pretty graphic, some of the descriptions that are made in these sorts of telegrams.
Yes, I mean, people feel they can be frank with ministers, and ministers want frank advice from their diplomats about what's going on. And, of course, these documents will also have names of sources that have given information to the embassy. Now, maybe the committee will agree all of that should be redacted. That's going to be a huge and long process before anything becomes public. But the fact it's going on, I think, can have a chilling effect, can have collateral damage on our effectiveness. After all, in a world where we need diplomats, we need to know what's going on, I think that the committee need to sit down with the Foreign Office, have a serious discussion. What do they really want? I suspect what they want from the time he was ambassador actually were the kind of private WhatsApps and emails where Mandelson, the political operator, was continuing to use his network rather than the great swathe of diplomatic reporting he signed off as His Majesty's ambassador to Washington, you know, which is a very different category of thing, really.
Peter Ricketts, Lord Ricketts, thank you for joining us.
It's 20 past seven. It's been a gloomy new year for the jobs market. But as the pace of the downturn weakens, is there hope for a turnaround? Leanna Byrne is back with more on that. Morning again, Leanna.
Morning. Thanks, Anna. So, yes, new figures suggest the UK's hiring downturn eased a little in January, with permanent staff hiring falling at its slowest pace in 18 months. That's according to a report from KPMG and the Recruitment and Employment Confederation out this morning. Joining us now, Steve Rigby, co-chief executive of the family-run UK technology company Rigby Group, which employs 3,500 people in the UK. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Leanna.
Steve, this report suggests the jobs market is weakening more slowly, but it's still weakening. What's your reaction to that? And are you hiring or not?
You know, I think this report does show, unfortunately, persistent weakness. We've had about 220,000 jobs lost since the October 24 budget. So whilst we've got a tiny uptick here, We remain under pressure, partly through substantial increases in salary costs, running in this report at 4.7%, and in fact in public sector at 7.8%, which is really quite unsustainable. So I think the simple issue is, you know, from a productivity point of view, we haven't got sufficient enough growth to sustain more jobs in the economy, and that looks to persist for at least the early part of 2026.
So has your headcount stayed the same?
We are pretty static. I mean, it's in an environment where, you know, we've had an economy in the last 6 months that's moved, you know, a very small percentage, about 0.3%, and inflation at 3%. As I say, with that wage salary move of nearly 5%, the only option you have is either to sustain your jobs or, in fact, potentially find lower cost routes for those jobs through outsourcing or AI.
Is there a single biggest thing stopping you from hiring more people? Is it weak demand, rising employment costs, government policy perhaps?
We really believe in employing people. Excuse me, we have 8,000 people across the world, 3,500 here in the UK. We'd love to scale that workforce higher, but it does require an economy to move. You know, we do have a lot of confidence in the UK in the long term. I know there's a lot of naysayers out there, but we do believe in the UK as a very material global market, both today and in the future. So we just need to find some growth in the economy and a reduction for inflation.
Mm. Now, the data shows strong wage growth for highly skilled workers. Is that a good thing for you, though?
Well, we are a very skilled workforce. I mean, for us, we're employing technical people. We're a technology business. Actually, they remain in significant demand, especially as we undertake this massive transition towards a new world with AI. So I think skilled workers, those that are adapting to the modern day world, will always do well. The challenge really is, how do we get more people to make that transition? And I think learning and development is a really an important issue for the country to consider, both in government and in business.
All right, Steve Rigby, co-chief executive of the family-run UK technology Rigby Group, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Leanna. It's now 23 minutes past seven. In recent weeks, I hope you've been enjoying some of our country's best-known authors reading from the book that ignited or reignited their love of reading. We've been doing that to mark the National Year of Reading. And today it's the turn of Wendy Cope, known for collections including Making Cocoa for Kingsley Amis and The Orange and Other Poems. She's chosen the two Winnie the Pooh books by A.A. Milne. She reads from Winnie the Pooh, first published here in the UK, in 1926 by Methuen.
The Pooh books, Winnie the Pooh and House at Pooh Corner, both by A.A. Milne and both equally wonderful. I don't remember when I first came across Pooh, but someone probably read it to me when I was very young. But what I will never forget is the joyous moment when I was 7 or 8 years old, when I picked up one of these books and I realised how funny it was. And I lay there on my bed reading and laughing. And I've loved the books ever since, and I've never grown out of enjoying them. Also, they have wonderful illustrations by E.H. Shepherd, which are perfect. My idea of those characters is how they look in E.H. Shepherd's illustrations. This is chapter 3 of Winnie the Pooh, in which Pooh and Piglet go hunting and nearly catch a woozle. "What do you see there?" "Tracks," said Piglet. "Paw marks." He gave a little squeak of excitement. "Oh, Pooh! Do you think it's a woozle?" "It may be," said Pooh. "Sometimes it is, and sometimes it isn't. You can never tell with paw marks." With these few words, he went on tracking, and Piglet, after watching him for a minute or two, ran after him. Winnie the Pooh had come to a sudden stop and was bending over the tracks in a puzzled sort of way. "What's the matter?" said Piglet. "It's a very funny thing," said Bear, "but there seem to be two animals now. This, whatever it was, has been joined by another, whatever it is, and the two of them are now proceeding in company. Would you mind coming with me, Piglet, in case they turn out to be hostile animals?" Piglet scratched his ear in a nice sort of way and said that he had nothing to do until Friday and would be delighted to come in case it really was a woozle. "You mean in case it really is two woozles," said Winnie the Pooh. And Piglet said that anyhow he had nothing to do until Friday, so off they went together. What's enchanting about the Pooh books is the characters. The characters are so funny and interesting, and there's a lot of kindness and love in this book. Pooh is a really nice chap. I sometimes talk to other people about them, enjoy them, and we sometimes refer to things from the Pooh books. I mean, my husband and I sometimes refer to things from the Pooh books. These days, I particularly enjoy the character of Owl, who thinks of himself as an intellectual but can't spell his own name. I find him perhaps more amusing than I did when I was a little girl. And perhaps Eeyore, the gloomy Eeyore. I recognise something of myself in Eeyore and something of a lot of people I know.
It's funny how it changes as you get older, isn't it? And certain other layers come out of those characters that you thought you knew so well.
They're glorious. I've been re-listening, actually, because of the lovely Radio 4 series, Who, Which Pooh Are You? Or is it some called something like that? But Who Are You in Winnie the Pooh? Forgive me. Which is a lovely series about whether you're a piglet or a Pooh or an Eeyore.
Yeah, we need that kind of joy in our lives, don't we, at the moment? I think we really do. It's 27 minutes past seven. Carthy is back with the sport. Hello again.
Morning. Yes, it was the Manchester City fans that were bouncing around after their victory yesterday. An important 2-1 win at Liverpool in a fascinating game, which in the context of the Premier League title race is a big result for second place City, who have cut Arsenal's lead to 6 points. Crystal Palace beat Brighton Brighton 1-0 and move into 13th place, while Celtic will host Rangers in the Scottish Cup quarterfinals. England survived a scare at the T20 Cricket World Cup when Nepal took their match down to the final ball, England winning by just 4 runs. Ireland lost to Sri Lanka by 20 runs, and Scotland are in action right now against Italy and Kolkata. Scotland set a target of 208. Italy are 9-1 after 2 overs. Now, the Six Nations started on Thursday for the first time to avoid clashing with the opening ceremony of the Winter Olympics. France beat Ireland 36-14 in that opening game. Then over the weekend, England outpowered Wales 48-7 and Scotland lost to Italy 15. The BBC's rugby correspondent Chris Jones joins us. I was going to say, you can't speak probably after the amount of commentary you've done. I can't speak this morning. We've seen all the teams for the first time this year. Who impressed you most over the last few days, Chris?
Yeah, well, as you say, I had a ringside seat for both the France and the England games, and they were both very impressive. France, that was a statement, wasn't it? A message to the rest of the championship on Thursday night. England, though, very good too against Wales. Ireland, a better team than Wales, which maybe makes France's win a little bit more impressive, but both teams very good. Pre-tournament, Carthy, we did expect England and France to be the two best teams, the two teams going for the title, the two main contenders. And that opening weekend has only reinforced that.
At the other end, though, how damaging were those defeats for Scotland and Wales?
Yeah, damaging is a good word. Nothing was expected of Wales. They were on a hiding to nothing coming to London, and even the most optimistic Welsh fans, I don't think, thought that it would be a famous day to rival 2012 or 2015 when Wales won in Twickenham. But nonetheless, I think that first half performance was meek and disappointing. But, you know, meek and disappointing words you could use to sum up Scotland. As always, there was that little bit of some simmering excitement from Scotland fans about what could be achieved this championship, and that balloon's been popped a little bit. England in town next week, they will raise themselves for the Calcutta Cup, they always do, but big pressure on this Scotland team and their boss, Gregor Townsend, now.
Well, you mentioned that game next weekend. What do you think will be the big story or stories of the next round of Six Nations fixtures?
Yeah, hard to get away from the Calcutta Cup. Yeah. It's been a brilliant game over the last few years. Scotland have had England's number. England did nick a win last year at home, but otherwise Scotland have dominated this fixture. England haven't won in Edinburgh in 6 years. So even though England go to France on the final day, it has the look of a title decider. No chat about that in the England camp. They're talking just about Edinburgh, just about Murray Field and trying to right some wrongs of the last few visits there. So that's a huge game. Wales have France rolling into town. Probably the last group of players they want to see coming to Cardiff are the French, with all their power, panache and squad depth. But a word about the other game of the weekend, which will be Ireland against Italy. Normally a one-sided game, easy to call. That could be a little bit interesting because Italy, having gone 7 years without a Six Nations win from 2015 to 2022, now have 4 Six Nations wins in their last 8 games. Their improvement has been enormous and they travel to Dublin with confidence.
Great. Look forward to it, Chris Jones. Thank you very much. Thanks. In the last few hours, the Seattle Seahawks beat the New England Patriots 29-13 to claim their second Super Bowl victory. And at the Winter Olympics today, look out for Great Britain's Kirsty Muir in the freestyle skiing women's slopestyle final, and 19-year-old snowboarder Mir Brooks has qualified for the big air final. That is later this evening.
Carthy, thank you. Radio 4's new book at bedtime is a reimagining of a classic text.
Radio 4's Story of America.
My name is James.
The award-winning reimagining of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn.
I was sold when I was born, and then sold again.
One man's story of running from slavery in search of freedom.
I can tell you that I am a man who has a family, who has been torn from his family.
James by Percival Everett begins tonight at 10:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
I am James. Just James.
The weather this morning will be largely cloudy with spots of drizzle. We haven't seen the back of the rain just yet, but it should turn dry later with some brightness developing in the afternoon.
Coming up later in the programme, we'll be joined by the Leader of the Opposition, Kemi Badenoch, in about 20 minutes' time. We'll hear from the government, the Labour veteran, Jackie Smith, Baroness Smith, at 8:10, as the Prime Minister has a battle on his hands to shore up his continued occupancy of 10 Downing Street.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster. It's 28 minutes to 8. Tom Sanders is here with a summary of the news.
Sir Keir Starmer will face Labour MPs today in a bid to garner their support, which has been threatened by the scandal surrounding Lord Mandelson. The Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney, resigned yesterday, saying he took full responsibility for advising Sir Keir to appoint the peer as the UK's ambassador to Washington. There's been criticism from some Labour MPs who say the final decision was taken by the Prime Minister and that he should be held accountable. Others have warned against a change in leadership. The senior Labour MP, Dame Emily Thornbury, told us Sir Keir was a strong leader but needed to step up more than he has. The pro-democracy media tycoon Jimmy Lai has been sentenced to 20 years in prison by a court in Hong Kong. The 78-year-old British citizen was found guilty in December on charges under the strict national security law imposed by Beijing. The Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper described the prosecution as politically motivated and called on Hong Kong's authorities to release Mr. Lai. The Prince of Wales will begin his first official trip to Saudi Arabia today. Ministers view the diplomatic relationship with the Gulf state as strategically important, despite concerns about the kingdom's human rights record. A group of MPs has warned that hundreds of thousands of social homes in England failed to meet basic standards. The report from the Housing, Communities and Local Government Committee says many residents do not have their complaints taken seriously and repairs are slow. The government said it was taking action to drive up the quality of social housing. The man convicted of shooting 51 people dead at two mosques in New Zealand 7 years ago has begun an appeal against his conviction and sentence. Brenton Tarrant says he was incapable of making decisions when he admitted his guilt because of conditions inside prison. Universities have been told to report threats of foreign interference directly to government and security services. Institutions were warned that hostile actors, including China and Russia, try to target staff and students to influence research and teaching content.
Thank you, Tom. Prince William has travelled to Saudi Arabia on his first official visit to the kingdom. He's there at the request of the UK government to strengthen investment ties and to talk about shared priorities like green energy. But Saudi Arabia's record on human rights abuses, even as it tries to rehabilitate itself on the world stage, makes the trip a more challenging one than usual. Daniela Ralph, our senior royal correspondent, is in Riyadh with Prince William. Daniela, how will the palace account for some of the issues that will loom large on this trip?
Well, Anna, the Prince of Wales arrived here in Riyadh a little bit later on today, as you say, his first ever trip to Saudi Arabia. And it is one of the trickier diplomatic relationships that he has been asked to step into as Prince of Wales. Now, he is here, as all royal trips are, at the request of the UK government, who wanted William to come because they view this as such a important strategic relationship, the most important, they say, in this region. There is also a personal relationship at stake here as well. The UK government would like William to build a personal relationship with the effective leader of Saudi Arabia, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who we are expecting him to spend some time with during his 3-day visit. They don't know each other well at all right now, but they are a similar age, and the government feels very much that that would be a useful relationship to invest in. This is a top-down system here in Saudi Arabia. If you impress at the top, that does trickle down, and that's very much on the UK government's mind. There have been an awful lot of UK politicians coming through Saudi Arabia over the past year or so, but what Prince William does is offer continuity. As we know, politicians come and go, but as a future king, there is a chance for him to build these long trusted relationships. But as you said, there is this problem here. It's tricky. This is an authoritarian regime. It is an absolute monarchy, and political protest is severely sanctioned. These issues are likely to come up during discussions. William will have taken advice on what subjects to raise and how to raise them. And I think, you know, the reality is that whatever his personal beliefs and concerns may be during this trip, he may have to put some of those aside in order to support the programme of the UK government.
Daniela Ralph, our senior royal correspondent in Riyadh, she'll be following Prince William's trip there. Thank you. Let's also speak to Simon Collis, former British ambassador to Saudi Arabia, who's now a consultant based in the Middle East who advises businesses. Good morning.
Good morning.
How would Prince William best be advised? As Daniela said there, he'll have been given advice about how to raise and discuss some of those difficult issues. What is the best way for him to approach it?
Yes, I think Daniela set out the issues very well. Saudi Arabia is a country that matters hugely to British trade and investment interests. It's been changing rapidly over the last 10 years. there's a lot more openness than there was previously. Sectors that were never central to our relationship have opened up across education and culture and sport and environmental issues, green energy and so on, as she mentioned. And I think the visit needs to be seen in that light. It's also not just the major regional country. It is an emerging middle power, a member of the G20. So what the country says and does matters. It is an absolute monarchy, as Daniela said. So the relationship with the king and the crown prince and between the royal families matters. And I think this visit by two men, which would include meetings between two men of similar age and a similar position, is really important for the long term. As for these issues, I think we've had a series of ministerial visits over not just the last year, but the last seven, eight years. It's been an intense engagement. So the Prince of Wales visit will not be exceptional in that sense. Mm. Human rights matters are really best taken forward in private and on a government to government level. They're part of the picture, but they're not the only thing.
No, the optics can be complex, though. I was in Jeddah for Joe Biden's visit when he was president, and the fact that he was seen fist bumping Mohammed bin Salman, that particular image was one that the White House were not particularly keen to see projected around the world. But I wonder, you know, when it comes to Saudi Arabia's relationship with other countries as a global power, you talk there about the changes, and there have been so many of them in the last few years, but driven more by the kingdom's changing reliance on oil and the need to look out rather than look in, as it has for so long.
Yes, I mean, I think that's right, that there are various reasons for it. And I think in the first place, many of these changes, for example, the transformation in the position of women in this country, who, you know, before King Salman took over and the Crown Prince rose and to authority and launched the Vision 2030 transformation program, women couldn't travel, they couldn't get a job, they couldn't drive, they couldn't even get access to healthcare without the approval of a male guardian. All that's gone, massively gone. So the human rights of half of the population have changed right there. And I think as an absolute monarchy, when they do this, first of all, this has to come first down, top down. And secondly, I think we need to understand that the Saudi authorities, when they make these changes, they're not doing it to please us. They're doing it for themselves. And that, in a sense, gives us greater confidence about the commitment to it. It's not cosmetic, it's substantive.
Simon Collis, former British ambassador to Saudi Arabia, thank you for joining us.
The time now is 8:20, and we turn to the Super Bowl. Now, you might think it was all about sport, it was all about football, but last night's Super Bowl is likely to be remembered as much for culture and politics as for all that. The organisers of one of the biggest sporting events on the planet chose the world's most played artist, Puerto Rican Grammy Award winner Benito Antonio Martini Ocasio, better known as Bad Bunny, to perform at halftime in Spanish. It was expected he might use that appearance to make a political statement against the current US administration after he did speak out against ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, at last week's Grammy Awards. Instead, he used his appearance to promote a message of American unity. That didn't stop Donald Trump calling the performance absolutely terrible, one of the worst ever, capital letters, of course, and an affront, as he put it, to the greatness of America. I've been speaking about what this performance really means for the United States to Noah Shachtman, the former editor-in-chief of Rolling Stones magazine, who talked about why this Super Bowl performance was so unique.
Absolutely. I think it really was nothing like any other Super Bowl halftime show. It was more like a movie. It was more like a production at the West End. It was cinematic. It had multiple sets. It wasn't really a concert in the ways that we're accustomed to seeing. There was even an actual wedding in the middle of it. It was wild.
And a Latino speaking in Spanish in a way that just offended everything Donald Trump says he stands for.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. In fact, Donald Trump's response was, and I quote, "No one could understand what the guy was saying, and the dancing was disgusting." It was unbelievable. It was like a cartoon villain's response.
But presumably the guys who booked Bad Bunny knew precisely what they were doing and who they were trying to appeal to.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Look, this is the most streamed artist in the world. Okay, this is a man of enormous influence, enormous cultural influence, and enormous popularity in the United States and around the world. And what's more, Latin music and music in Spanish is now as popular in the United States of America as good old-fashioned country music is in the United States of America. The producers knew exactly what they were doing.
You write in the New York Times, English is no longer culture's lingua franca. It's that dramatic a shift, is it?
Yeah, it really is. Look, it doesn't mean that English isn't still incredibly important, and that acts from, you know, Dua Lipa to The Weeknd to, you know, every rapper that comes out of my home borough of Brooklyn doesn't still have enormous cultural sway. But they've been joined by a panoply of other acts speaking in a bunch of different languages, most notably Spanish and Korean.
For plenty of viewers, this is just about music that I either like or loathe. How much is it about politics, though, and what Bad Bunny represents as a kind of rebuke to the President of the United States?
Yeah, it's both. Look, the show was 99%, you know, just music and just a celebration of Puerto Rican culture. But in that proud celebration and in that unapologetic presentation of the music, there's a political message, which is that, you know, Puerto Ricans and Latin Americans are not going to be cowed by a president who's really set out to target them by the millions.
Targeted them so much that I understand that Bad Bunny said he couldn't do gigs on his latest tour because his fear was that ICE agents, Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, would target the crowd who turned up.
Yeah, that's right. And he forego an estimated $500 million in concert gross by doing so. And it's not that he said he couldn't, but he said he wouldn't do gigs and he wouldn't subject his fans to that kind of potential abuse. And so instead, he set up a residency in Puerto Rico, where he played several dozen shows, representations of which and echoes of which were actually in that Super Bowl halftime performance, and it generated hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue for Puerto Rico.
Finally, Noah, if we are in a culture war, who won last night?
I mean, I think Bad Bunny won hands down. You know, it was a unapologetic, proud, wild, can't take your eyes off it, can't take your ears out of it, star-studded performance. And I thought it was, you know, whether you liked it or hated it, it was mesmerizing.
Noah Shachtman, former editor of Rolling Stone magazine, contributor to the New York Times. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's 7:45 now. It's time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is Bishop Nick Baines, the former Bishop of Leeds.
Good morning. 45 years ago, I met a man whose story intrigued me. His name was Dr. Vlodo Totsky, and he came to Cheltenham once a week to give Russian conversation practice to me and colleagues when we were training at GCHQ. I only knew him for 6 months or so, and he died in 1985. Now, I think his story haunted me over the years because it was hard to believe. He was born in Russian-occupied Manchuria during the Russo-Japanese War in 1904, lived in Kyiv during the Russian Revolution, fought in Poland as part of the resistance during World War II, took part in the Warsaw Uprising, was a prisoner of war more than once, then spent the post-war years in London with the Polish government in exile. He was clear that his vocation was to live long enough to document everything from those times so that the Soviets could never deny the truth of what had gone on in Poland. Now, what's always intrigued me is this. What drove him to really dangerous choices that put his life on the line repeatedly? Which choices would I make if I were faced with the violence of corrupt government power and could either avoid conflict or stand up to it? Am I brave enough? Now, this month sees the beginning of Lent in the Christian calendar, which, surprisingly, is not about having a break from chocolate or booze. In fact, Lent creates space for asking hard questions. strip away the stuff of life that distracts me from facing up to who I really, really am and what really, really drives me, then I might have to face hard choices. It's no coincidence that the first words of Jesus in John's Gospel have him asking a hard question. What are you looking for? We could paraphrase it, what do you want from your life? What actually is really driving you? According to the other Gospels, Jesus could do this because he had already had to face them himself in the desert. What is your kingdom really about? A quick route to glory or the road to a cross? Now, such questions probe our fundamental motivations, but they open up the mind and imagination to the possibility that there might be more to my existence and our common life in society, to truth, integrity, courage, failure, and fear. Very contemporary. I want to know more about what made Vlod Otoczki choose, but I also want to examine myself in order to sort out the truth from the fantasies that so easily obscure reality.
That was Thought for the Day with Bishop Nick Baines, the former Bishop of Leeds. It's 12 minutes to 8.
MPs gasped when the Prime Minister revealed that, yes, he had known about the links between the man he chose to make ambassador to the United States, Lord Mandelson, and the convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. It was a revelation extracted by the leader of the opposition, Kemi Badenoch, who now says Starmer didn't just know, he chose not to care. Kemi Badenoch joins us in the Today studio this morning.
Good morning.
Spell that out. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that he was well aware of the risks he was taking and was happy to take them. He thought that he'd played a blinder. And the only reason why he is now claiming not to know is because he's trying to avoid people looking at his judgment. The Prime Minister has terrible judgment. Back in September, I asked him the very same questions which I asked last week, apart from one, and he claimed to have full confidence in Peter Mandelson, even as all these revelations were coming out. So what's changed?
You raised doubts about Lord Mandelson's suitability, about some of his business links with China and elsewhere. You did not say, because he has a relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, and that continued even after he had a conviction for paedophilia, he is unsuitable to be ambassador. So aren't you being wise after the event?
No, not at all. And in fact, many Conservatives raised concerns. Ian Duncan-Smith, Caroline Dynage, we put down parliamentary questions. I have a big team. It's not just me doing this work. I'm not a one-man band.
But to be clear, the leader of the opposition did not raise that.
No, I was raising all the problems that he was creating in the economy, his endless U-turns, national grooming gangs, scandal, the terrible policies. There was a lot I was raising. I can't do it all on my own. I do have a team of people.
Yep.
And we were correct to raise those issues. Many things were in the public domain, but the fact of the matter remains, the Prime Minister chose to make this appointment despite his vetting information telling him otherwise. I didn't have access to the vetting at the time. That's something I only found out last week. Why didn't he listen to it?
The question for today, then, is whether it is enough for him to say, I was badly advised, I was lied to, the vetting was not good enough, or you think today is to say, what, I quit as Prime Minister? Is that really?
Well, none of those three things are credible. I was badly advised is not a good, it's not a good excuse for a leader. Advisors advise, leaders decide. He made a bad decision. He should take responsibility for that. Claiming that he was lied to. This man said he was the chief prosecutor for the country. When did he start believing everything that people told him? Peter Mandelson had been sacked twice for unethical behavior. He is allowing someone else to carry the can for a decision that he chose to make. But the real problem is that the country's not being governed. He is distracted. He is all over the place. Resets, endless missions, U-turns. That's what's really going wrong with this government. They're not governing the country.
That is a perfectly reasonable point to make as leader of the opposition. Mm. Of course it is. That's what you'll do. You're paid to oppose. You're also paid to put the public interest first. Is it really in the public interest at a moment of war in Europe, rising tensions and possibility of war in the Middle East, a global trade war and a stagnating economy, to say that we should change Prime Minister again because you think he made one bad call?
Oh, this is not about one bad call. This is just the most obvious example of terrible judgment. He has made bad decision after bad decision.
But you think he should go? Keir Starmer, it's in the nation's interests, in your mind, that Keir Starmer should go, with all the instability that will create, the uncertainty that will create.
He needs to start governing the country. Everybody makes mistakes. How you handle them shows what sort of character you are. And what he is showing is that he is weak. I don't think that there is a single better person on the Labour benches. Let's just be clear. The problem is the Labour Party. It's the Labour government that should go.
Sure, and I bet they're not going to... when I say, should he go?
No,
this something that means the Prime Minister of this country should fall? Or, coming from the leader of a party that gave us Boris Johnson and Liz Truss, do you think attacking someone's judgment is a bit rich?
No, not at all. I'm the one who's making this call, and this is about me. I'm the leader of my party now, not Boris Johnson, not Liz Truss. And don't get me wrong, Nick, we made mistakes, but at least we tried to deal with them. I'm not saying that we were perfect, not at all, but they are worse. Keir Starmer promised a government that would be whiter than white. His position now is untenable, because if he thinks that bad advice is enough for Morgan McSweeney to go, then yes, I think that makes his position untenable. This goes well beyond what's happening around just this decision.
But let's focus, if you would, on that decision still.
Yes.
Keir Starmer never met Jeffrey Epstein.
That's true.
Keir Starmer had nothing to do with Jeffrey Epstein. Keir Starmer was not even in Parliament, let alone Prime Minister, when Peter Mandelson sent secret confidential documents to Jeffrey Epstein. His sole contribution was to make what he and everybody else admits now was a bad call to make Peter Mandelson US ambassador. I ask you again, is that enough of an offence to change the Prime Minister of this country?
It is only the latest in a series of bad calls and bad judgments. If it's not enough of an offence to change the Prime Minister, then why is it an offence for the Chief of Staff to go? Let's be perfectly honest. Keir Starmer knew. He knew. It is his judgment and the fact that he has been dishonest. He was dishonest. He claimed not to know. Then he changed his story and then claimed that actually he'd been lied to. He is doing this on a whole range of issues.
What in this specific case are you claiming that he knew?
He's claimed not to know about the continuing relationship with Peter Mandelson, that Peter Mandelson had with Epstein. And now, only last week, only after the pressure that I put on him, did he confess that that information was in the security vetting. He had a chance, for example, back in September, to release the files that were related to the vetting. He chose not to do so. Now, we have had to force, it was Conservatives who forced the full release of the files, which are now, you know, probably giving more than he wanted. This is bad judgment.
Is Every it not decision also bad makes, for Britain what Parliament, led by you in this case, has ordered the government to do? We were hearing from Lord Ricketts, former senior Foreign Office diplomat, saying that now we are going to get hundreds, if not thousands, of confidential documents, of emails, WhatsApp messages and the rest, vital to the good operation of public policy in this country, about what British diplomats believe about Donald Trump or other key people in his administration. And they're being released so that you can embarrass
At all. In fact, that is specifically why I said that if they're sensitive matters, they should go to the Intelligence and Security Committee. That is a very top secret private committee that can look at those things. So they don't need to be embarrassed by things which would create the chilling effect that Peter Ricketts has described. But yet again, it didn't have to go this far. He could have released the files relating to the appointment. He chose not to do so because he's scared, he is weak, he throws other people under a bus. He's got no backbone. That's why he shouldn't be Prime Minister. This is an example of the sort of character we have leading the country. And yes, I know there are many worse people on the Labour benches. This is something that I've been saying for a very long time. But for us to just pretend that the country is being governed and this was a minor oversight rather than a reveal of what sort of man is running our country would be wrong. It is my job to make sure that people can see where he has gone wrong. I am doing my job. None of this would happen if I had not done so.
Would it not reveal what we are as a country if we were to change Prime Minister yet again? Not a single Prime Minister has stayed in office for longer than 3 years since David Cameron. We are becoming an international laughingstock as a country. We look like Italy in my youth, constantly changing Prime Minister, constantly damaging our international reputation, constantly perhaps getting things just ever so slightly out of proportion.
I think that we have a prime minister who has no agenda for the country, who is not running the government at all. He is only concerned about his job security. I don't think that things can get much worse than that. That is a real problem. The point about changing prime minister is to make sure that we have somebody who can deliver for the country, deliver for your listeners. Well, look at what's happening with the economy. Unemployment increased every single month since he came into office. Everything is getting worse.
Kemi Badenoch, the issue. Leader of the opposition. Thank you for joining us in the Today.
Thank you, Nick.
It's 3 minutes to 8. Across this week, Radio 4 is examining the rise of weight loss drugs.
We've spoken to scientists who researched the drug, doctors that have run the trials for these drugs. We've spoken to everyone you can think of.
The inside story of the weight loss drug revolution with Professor Giles Yeo.
I research how the brain responds to these drugs, where the drugs bind to, and what they could be doing within the brain.
A new 5-part series exploring how they work, their surprising origins, and their far-reaching impact.
These are drugs that are influencing far more than you might imagine in your life.
The Hunger Game on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds this Monday to Friday lunchtime at 1:45.
Now, we know it's going to be wet, but how wet and where? Sarah Keith Lucas can tell us.
Well, Nick, we have still got over 100 flood warnings in force across central and southern England, eastern Scotland too. And there's more rain for many of us over the next couple of days before, thankfully, the weather looks drier later in the week and a bit colder. But for today, it's the southwest of England and South Wales again that's going to see the most persistent rain. A yellow rainfall warning comes into force at midday today. So showers here through the morning, but heavier, more persistent rain into the afternoon. The winds will pick up too. For the southeast of England, into the Midlands and for parts of eastern England, some mist and fog patches, some drizzly outbreaks of rain too, but it should tend to brighten up a little bit into the afternoon. Some glimpses of blue sky possible. For North Wales, into northern England and all of Scotland, it is going to be a cloudy, grey, damp sort of day. Some fog patches across the east of Scotland. So on and off showers, particularly through the morning. Into the afternoon, fewer showers around, but still one or two lingering, particularly up towards the Northern Isles, where it's going to be windy again today. Northern Ireland, we have got some fog patches at the moment. They should clear away fairly quickly, and then a bit of sunshine through the morning, but cloudier into the afternoon with some showery rain at times. Temperatures today between about 8 to 12 degrees, so still quite mild north to south. And tonight looks cloudy and damp still. It'll be frost-free with temperatures holding up around about 4 to 8 degrees. More cloud and outbreaks of rain for some of us tomorrow, and things gradually turn drier later in the week.
That's good to hear. Thank you, Sarah. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Monday, the 9th of February. The headlines this morning. Sir Keir Starmer will address Labour MPs later today, many of them hostile. He's hoping to convince them he remains their best option as Prime Minister in the wake of the Mandelson affair. We'll be speaking to the veteran Labour Minister, Baroness Smith, who's speaking for the government this morning at 8:10. The government says it'll rapidly engage further with Jimmy Lai's case after the British pro-democracy campaigner was jailed for 20 years in Hong Kong. And the Prince of Wales is to hold talks with Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, on his first official visit to the kingdom.
Also coming up this hour, in an attempt to increase the country's dwindling birth rate, France is going to send a letter to all 29-year-olds encouraging them to have babies before it's too late. And Aberdeen has had no sunshine at all since the 21st of January. That is 20 days, the longest sunless period on record. So what impact, as if we needed to ask, does that have on your mood?
It doesn't make you happy, is it? Let's face it, Aberdeen's grey as it is it?
So I feel like I'm constantly wet and cold. But other than that, you just have to get on with it. Brighter days are coming.
The BBC News is read by Tom Sanders.
Sir Keir Starmer will address Labour MPs today as he fights to shore up his leadership, which has been threatened by the scandal surrounding Lord Mandelson. The Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney, resigned yesterday, saying he took full responsibility for advising Sir Keir to appoint the peer as the UK's ambassador to Washington. Our Chief Political Correspondent, Henry Zeffman, reports from Downing Street.
Sir Keir Starmer's breakup with Morgan McSweeney does not allow the Prime Minister to draw a line under the Lord Mandelson scandal, but it gives him a whisper of breathing space in which to make his case to Labour MPs. He will do so tonight, arguing that Lord Mandelson's behaviour was corrosive to the idea that politics can make a difference, and stressing that he has plans for reform to lobbying rules and to the government appointments process. Many MPs are likely to be receptive for now, not least because most plausible alternative prime ministers come with complications. The Prime Minister's hopes of moving on may be muddied, though, by lingering acrimony in government about Mr McSweeney's departure. Allies of the former Chief of Staff described Sir Keir's willingness to part with him as pointless, ridiculous and cowardly. The last time Sir Keir was without Mr McSweeney as his chief adviser, he was a loyal member of Jeremy Corbyn's shadow cabinet. It is unclear what Starmerism looks like without Mr McSweeney, and unclear how long he will get to show us.
The senior Labour MP, Dame Emily Thornbury, told us Sir Keir was a decent man, but that he needed to reset and unite the party.
He's a good leader in that he is strong and clear. I think that he needs to step up a bit more than he has. First of all, I think, on the one hand, we as a party need to be pretty united, right? From the leaflet deliverer to the cabinet member, we need to be united and we need to know where we're going and we need to stick together. But we do need to have a clear leadership, and that's his challenge. So we reset and he needs to reset as well.
But the leader of the Conservatives, Kevin Badenoch, told us the Prime Minister should go.
Keir Starmer promised a government that would be whiter than white. His position now is untenable, because if he thinks that bad advice is enough for Morgan McSweeney to go, then yes, I think that makes his position untenable. This goes well beyond what's happening around just this decision.
A court in Hong Kong has sentenced the pro-democracy campaigner Jimmy Lai to 20 years in prison. The media tycoon, who's a British citizen, was convicted in December on charges of foreign collusion and sedition. Responding to the sentence, the Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper said the government would rapidly engage further on Mr Lai's case. Martin Yip sent this report from outside the court.
This is the harshest punishment yet handed out under Hong Kong's strict national security law, which was imposed by China in 2020 in response to large and sometimes violent pro-democracy protests. Jimmy Lai nodded as the judge announced his sentence, while his wife and former reporters from his now-defunct Apple Daily newspaper burst into tears. Rights groups have condemned the 20-year term, calling it effectively a death sentence for the 78-year-old and a grave injustice. Mr. Lai's family described it as draconian and cruel. Last month, Sir Keir Starmer raised Jimmy Lai's case with China's President Xi Jinping when the two leaders met in Beijing. The Prime Minister previously said that securing his release was a priority for his government. Jimmy Lai has always denied the charges against him, saying he had advocated for what he believed were Hong Kong's values, including the rule of law and free speech.
The Prince of Wales will begin his first official trip to Saudi Arabia today. The three-day visit will focus on trade, energy and young people. Our senior royal correspondent Daniela Ralph reports from Riyadh.
After a week in which the royal family has been under intense scrutiny as a result of the Epstein files, the Prince of Wales's visit to Saudi Arabia is an attempt to return to business as usual, if that is possible. He'll be in the country for 3 days at the request of the UK government, who view it as their most strategically important relationship in the region. Forging stronger ties with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman will be a priority. Later today, the Crown Prince will give William a tour of an historic site, and the pair will have a private audience. On the agenda will be the modernisation of Saudi Arabia, but it remains a country under an authoritarian regime ruled by an absolute monarchy where political protesters are severely sanctioned.
Japan's main stock index has hit a record high after the country's first female prime minister, Sanae Takaichi, won a landslide election victory. Her Liberal Democratic Party secured its best ever result, taking more than two-thirds of the seats in the lower house of the Japanese parliament. Our correspondent Shami Khalil reports from Tokyo.
Sanae Takaichi's gamble calling a snap election in the depths of winter has paid off and marks a sharp turnaround for the LDP, which had lost its majority under her predecessor. The result gives her party near-total legislative control, clearing the way for faster, more decisive policymaking and reducing the political constraints that weakened previous prime ministers. Ms. Takaichi is known for her pro-business stance. She's pledged tax cuts and increased spending to revive the Japanese economy as households continue to feel the strain of rising costs.
But this victory also brings pressure on her to explain how those promises will be funded and whether they can be sustained over time. Beyond the economy, Ms. Takaichi has committed to boosting defense spending, revising Japan's pacifist constitution, and tightening immigration rules.
A white supremacist who shot dead 51 people at two mosques in New Zealand has appeared in court in Wellington to try to withdraw his guilty plea. Brenton Tarrant is serving a whole life sentence after the attack on worshippers during Friday prayers in Christchurch in 2019. Our correspondent Katie Watson reports.
It was in March 2020, a year after the attack, that Brenton Tarrant pleaded guilty to carrying out the deadliest mass shooting in modern-day New Zealand. This week's hearing seeks to withdraw that guilty plea and appeal against his sentence. The crux of his argument is that he wasn't able to make rational decisions because of what he has described as torturous and inhumane prison conditions. Local media reports say he told the Court of Appeals via a video link that if he had been given another option to pleading guilty, he would have taken it. If Tarrant is allowed to withdraw his guilty plea, the case would potentially go to trial on all charges. If he's not allowed to retract his plea, there'll be another hearing later in the year to consider his appeal against his sentence.
Train drivers in Spain are starting a three-day strike over safety concerns. The walkout has been prompted by two recent fatal rail accidents. Guy Hedgeco reports from Madrid.
Last month's accidents have cast doubt on a rail system that had long been the envy of many European countries. They have also led to severe disruption for rail travellers, as subsequent safety checks have revealed faults and maintenance issues on numerous routes. On the 18th of January, a high-speed train derailed in southern Spain, colliding with another one travelling in the opposite direction, causing 46 deaths. The investigation into the accident is focusing on a cracked section of track. 2 days later, in Catalonia, a trainee driver was killed when a collapsed wall caused a local train to derail. The striking drivers are demanding increased investment and maintenance and the hiring of more staff.
The Seattle Seahawks have won their second Super Bowl after beating the New England Patriots 29-13 in American football's showpiece event. The results mean Seattle's British defensive coordinator Aidan Durdee is the first overseas coach to win the United States' biggest game. The halftime show by the Puerto Rican artist Bad Bunny has been criticised by Donald Trump as one of the worst ever, after it was performed almost entirely in Spanish. Writing on social media, the US president claimed, "Nobody understands a word this guy is saying." There are high hopes of medals for Team GB at the Winter Olympics today. Our sports correspondent Andy Swiss has the latest from Cortina in northern Italy.
Britain's first hopes of a medal lie with skier Kirsty Muir, who qualified in third place for the slopestyle final. The Scot, who competed at the last Games aged just 17, has enjoyed an impressive season. Later on, teenage snowboarder Mia Brooks could become Britain's youngest Winter Olympic medalist for 78 years. Despite falling on her first jump in qualifying last night, she landed her next two to make it to the final of the Big Air event. And Team GB could guarantee themselves a medal in the curling mixed doubles. Bruce Mowat and Jen Dodds won 8 out of their 9 matches in the round-robin stage, and victory in this evening's semi-final would guarantee them either gold or silver.
Andy Swiss reporting.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. It is now 8:10. In an era of never-ending crises, of political division, of anger, it would be easy to think that the resignation of a man you may well never have heard of before the last few days is just another sign of stormy political weather. Easy? But wrong. Morgan McSweeney chose Keir Starmer as the man who could take Labour back to power with his help. He masterminded Labour's landslide election victory. He is now out of Downing Street. And the question Keir Starmer knows he must answer, and answer today when he speaks to Labour MPs, is why is an adviser paying the price for appointing Lord Mandelson, the friend of a convicted paedophile? Why isn't the man who took the decision paying the price? No member of the Cabinet was available to talk to us this morning, but the veteran Labour Minister, campaigner Jackie Smith, Baroness Smith, Minister for Skills and Minister for Women and Equalities, does join us on the line. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Nick.
We know how quickly things can change. Only yesterday we saw Pat McFadden, the Work and Pensions Secretary, tell us it would be pointless for Morgan McSweeney to give up his job. As you sit in front of the microphone this morning, are you sure that Keir Starmer isn't about to give up his job?
I am sure, yes. And just to be clear, it was the British people, Nick, that chose Keir Starmer to lead this government and asked him to, in a 5-year term, change the country. And that is what he's focused on. It's what I believed when I came.
He's told you that he will not resign, has he? Or has somebody who asked you to do this interview told you?
Well, when I came back into government, having talked to and considered what Keir Starmer was like and what I felt he would be like as Prime Minister, I was convinced that he believed that a Labour government can change the country.
Sure, but forgive me, that's not the question this morning. The question this morning is whether Keir Starmer, who's said to be in a very dark mood, may choose to quit.
I don't believe he will.
Has he said it to you? Have you spoken to him at all?
I have not spoken to him directly about this, but I don't believe he will. I don't think he should. And it was the British public that elected him to serve a 5-year term and to change this country.
Understood. Let's deal with the issue at hand then. Who was responsible for the appointment of Lord Mandelson, the friend of a convicted paedophile, as US ambassador?
Keir Starmer was responsible for making that decision, which is why, as soon as it became clear to him that the extent and nature of Peter Mandelson's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein was far greater and far more pernicious than anybody, in fact, had believed at the point at which he was appointed, he fired him. It's why he's apologised to Jeffrey Epstein's victims for having made that decision. And it's why he will now focus both on changing the appointments process and, more importantly, taking forward the work to tackle violence against women and girls. Because at the heart of this are rich and powerful men who across the world felt able with impunity to engage in and to facilitate the rape and abuse of young
women.
Well,
let's come to the detail of what you'll do in the future.
Well, that's quite an important issue.
Well, no, indeed it is an important issue. In fact, Jackie Smith, it is the issue. At the time Keir Starmer appointed Peter Mandelson, he was not just Prime Minister. He is the father of a teenage daughter. He appointed a man who he knew had stayed friends with a man who'd gone to prison, having admitted paying for sex with a girl of his daughter's own age. What on earth more did he need to know before deciding that Mandelson was not fit to be ambassador?
Well, lots of people, yourself, the Prime Minister and others, knew and understood at that point that Peter Mandelson had maintained contact with Jeffrey Epstein. What people didn't know at that point was the scale and nature of that relationship. They didn't know that he was an apologist, an encourager of Jeffrey Epstein. Mandelson had stayed at the house...
of a man who had paid underage girls for sex and had served time in prison for it. When you say we don't know the extent and nature, we don't know how pernicious it was, how much more pernicious could it be? What other extent did you need to know to say this man was not fit to be ambassador?
The point I make, Nick, is the Prime Minister accepts that he made the wrong decision. And I was just setting the context in which not only he, but plenty of other people understood the reason why Peter Mandelson was selected as our ambassador. However, when it became clear the nature of that relationship, you know, let's not forget Peter Mandelson lied continuously throughout this process.
But when it became clear, Jackie Smith, he had stayed at the house of a convicted paedophile. Yeah, now, people who are not mere friends do not just stay at the house of someone who served a prison sentence for paying underage girls for sex. What more did the Prime Minister need to know in order to conclude, without blaming the vetting and blaming Peter Mandelson's lies and blaming his chief advisor, what on earth more did he need to know to say, as a father, I will not countenance this?
Well, what I was making clear was the context, the understanding that a wide range of people had at that point. But I'm not saying that this was the right decision, nor is the Prime Minister. He's saying and has said he made a mistake. That is why he apologised to the victims of Jeffrey Epstein last week. That's why he's determined to put this and the broader issues about misogyny and violence against women and girls right. That's why he's determined to do that. And that's what he will be focusing on.
But the puzzle for people you see is this. You say quite candidly that he made the mistake and he's admitted making the mistake, but he's not the one paying the price. The person paying the price is Morgan McSweeney. He has lost his job. People want to know why. Well, the Prime Minister is responsible. Why doesn't he pay the price?
Well, Morgan McSweeney, in his resignation, I think was clear that he felt he needed to take responsibility for the advice he'd given to the Prime Minister. I suspect he also understands, as we've seen across the years, haven't we, Nick, that when the adviser becomes the story, it is a good idea for the adviser to step aside.
Mm. But we've also Keir Starmer himself said this. When he was leader of the Crown Prosecution Service, he's always said he's a public servant with a track record, I will carry the can for the mistakes of any organisation I lead. Where is the evidence that Keir Starmer is carrying the can?
That's exactly my point, Nick, that he is taking responsibility. He did fire Peter Mandelson. He has apologised for the appointment, including and importantly to the victims of Jeffrey Epstein. He will now lead efforts both to change the appointment process and, more importantly, to ensure that we continue to have at the heart of this government action to tackle violence against women and girls.
I do promise you I'm going to come to that detail, but I want to raise another issue with you which is related to it. Before I promise you, I'll give you the chance to outline the measures that you want to take later today. You see, something, there's a pattern of behaviour here, because not only did the Prime Minister choose to overlook the behaviour of Lord Mandelson in continuing to be friends with someone who had paid underage girls for sex, it's also the case then that his former adviser, Matthew Doyle, was given a seat in the House of Lords, despite the fact that he had defended a man charged with possessing and distributing indecent images of children. This does not sound like a leader, a prime minister, or a party who is convinced of the need to deal with violence against women and girls.
Well, I disagree with you about that, Nick. I first met the Prime Minister when I was the Home Secretary back in 2007, and he was the Director of Public Prosecutions. And the reason that I met him was because I was trying to work across government to tackle violence against women and girls. And he had led the Crown Prosecution Service in a way, I think, unlike what had happened previously, where there was a real focus on the victims of sexual abuse and rape and domestic.
So why was Matthew
abuse.
Doyle made so Lord Doyle, having campaigned for a man who is charged with possessing and distributing indecent images?
I don't think people are suggesting here that this is the same nature as what Peter Mandelson and Jeffrey Epstein were responsible for. But I'm simply making the point that, you know, one of the reasons why, as you say, as a veteran, I was happy and proud to come back into government in July 2024 was that I was clear from what I knew about Keir Starmer that he was a man that took that seriously, that wanted to change the country for the better, has started doing that in the last 18 months. And I think we should be supporting him to focus on carrying on doing that now.
The reason I push you on this is because for many who are concerned about violence against young women and girls, they think it is an absolute. You don't say, look, I know he was a friend with a convicted paedophile, but he's jolly good at negotiating trade agreements. I know he campaigned for someone who was possessing and distributing indecent images of children, but, you know, he's a jolly good chap and he worked alongside me. That isn't making a priority of stopping violence against women and girls.
Well, I disagree with you about whether or not the Prime Minister is prioritising that. I believe he is. And what's more, he's prioritising it across the whole of government. The decision to appoint Peter Mandelson was a mistake. The Prime Minister's been clear about that. He's taken responsibility for that. And he's taking responsibility for the work that we do in the future, both to tackle that issue and to change this country.
Let me give you the chance to talk about that, because you've been patient as I've been asking you questions about this. I want to talk about cleaning up politics, as he puts it, the Prime Minister, in a second. But what new are you saying he will now do as a result of this row in terms of dealing with violence against women and girls?
Well, I think, first of all, he will ensure that some of the changes that have already been started in terms of opening up government. Some of the things that Gordon Brown was talking about last week, for example, are put into practice quickly. This has also undermined trust in politics, and it's important that we're able to renew that and take the action necessary.
Just to be clear, for people who missed Gordon Brown on the programme on Saturday when he set it out in The Guardian as well, this is meaning US-style public hearings before another Mandelson-type appointment, so other people can raise questions and doubts.
Well, I think the Prime Minister will spell out the details of how that will happen, but he's clear that change needs to happen, and there has already been change, you know, strengthening the ministerial code, setting up the Ethics Commission, strengthening the position of the advisor on ministerial appointments. All of those things have already happened, but there's clearly more to do, and the Prime Minister will lead that. Secondly, on this point about violence against women and girls, you know, the Prime Minister had already been clear before the general election that halving violence and against women and girls over 10 years would be a key part of this government's strategy. The way of doing that was published just before Christmas, and he has driven that from the centre of government and will continue to do it. And he will, of course, also be responsible for the rest of the change that this government needs to see, not least in how we make sure that young people have the sort of opportunities in life that they need, which is exactly what I was originally going to be talking about with respect to National Apprenticeship Week this week.
Now, when the Prime Minister talks of cleaning up politics, which we're told he will, isn't it a bit rich to talk about cleaning up politics, not just after the Mandelson affair, not just after the appointment of Lord Doyle, a housing secretary forced to quit for not paying stamp duty, a homelessness minister resigning for being a dodgy landlord, an anti-corruption minister resigning for an anti-corruption investigation in another country, a transport secretary resigning after it emerged she'd been convicted of fraud, and a health minister resigning after joking he hoped a pensioner died before the next election. What clean-up?
Look, it has always been the case that government is hit by individuals who do the wrong thing, by scandals and resignations of the sort of nature that you're talking about. The judgment of a government and of a prime minister is how they deal with and respond to those issues, whether or not they do expect people to resign or sack them in those circumstances, and then what they do to ensure that the system is as clean and open as possible. And I'm absolutely convinced that the Prime Minister has that at the heart of what he's trying to do, and I and others should be supporting him in doing that.
Jackie Smith, Baroness Smith, thanks for taking the time to join us this morning.
Thank you, Nick.
Well, listening to that is our political editor, Chris Mason. Chris, good morning.
Morning, Anna.
Jackie Smith said there she hasn't spoken to the Prime Minister about the events of the last few days. You, on the other hand, have spoken to a number of people who have. And there are two things I'm keen to know. One is, what is he planning to do to try and get things back on track? And the other, we've heard so much about how angry he is about what's happened, what a dark mood he is. Just on a human level, how much stomach does he have for the fight? Does he really want to carry on doing this as all the shutters are coming down around him?
So I've spoken to plenty of people from the cabinet down since yesterday lunchtime when we got news of Morgan McSweeney's departure. Look, the most optimistic and most loyal, as far as the Prime Minister is concerned, sound doomy and gloomy. So you can imagine how some of the others are sounding. As far as the Prime Minister's mood is concerned, from those I've spoken to who spoke to him over the weekend, I was told he hates the idea that he's letting people down. That cuts very deep. He knows he has made a very big mistake. Multiple people, though, saying to me that he has resolve, for now at least, and has tremendous self-belief and does not want to be the instigator or author of another blast of turbulence in British politics. He's already the sixth Prime Minister in a decade. If he went and was replaced in the coming months, we would have the fifth Prime Minister in 4 years. But the key point to make here, Anna, is that the nature of where we are now, the Prime Minister is not in sole charge of his own destiny. And we're yet again, and this has happened quite a few times in the last couple of years, we are yet again in the zone of intense fluidity and volatility where anything seems possible, or at least nothing, would be entirely surprising.
Yes, it's not a good moment to try and predict anything, isn't it? So given that, the key moments to look out for, it seems to be, well, things like later today when he addresses the Parliamentary Labour Party. We heard from Andy MacDonald, a Labour backbencher earlier, who said if he doesn't own the error, it's coming to an end. You know, people are sort of, they're hinting, they're suggesting, there are very few who are coming out and saying he has to go. But when they do, if they do, that would be the turning point.
Exactly that. So at the moment, the number publicly saying it is pretty small. This meeting that's happening in Parliament at 6 o'clock this evening, it's a regular meeting. The Parliamentary Labour Party MPs and peers get together once a week on a Monday evening. The Prime Minister addresses them relatively often, as do other senior figures. For the Prime Minister, it is absolutely crucial, because he will be addressing the most important electorate in terms of his short-term future, his immediate future. In the end, backbench MPs, parliamentary parties can do for a Prime Minister. Just ask Liz Truss. He has to win them back round. Now, I think in the next few hours and days, he will set out his details for how he wants to, as he sees it, clean up politics, learn the lessons of the last week or so. But he also, in the view of plenty of the people I've been speaking to, has to do something that he has frequently been asked to do by those on his own side, which is set out clearly, definitively, what he stands for and what his government is all about. And he has to do that against an unprecedented backdrop, an unprecedented backdrop of no longer having the man who has been at his side from the moment he was running for the Labour leadership and those years in opposition and in government, Morgan McSweeney. How does Keir Starmer's leadership without Morgan McSweeney look? We are finding out for the first time from this morning onwards.
Just a final brief thought, Chris. What about those senior people around him, the cabinet, the ones who are sometimes described as the people in the grey suits who'll have a quiet word in your ear and say, you know what, the game's up? What is the feeling from them?
Well, doomy and gloomy is the feeling. There is a real awareness that this is the last roll of the dice, the last chance saloon. Two of the remarks scribbled into my notebook from conversations last night. There is a keen awareness from everyone I speak to about the magnitude of this moment, the peril that the Prime Minister faces. Were any senior figures or a collection of figures, some sort of delegation to go public, that could be a massive, massive game changer here. It is also possible, given that potential successors have their own challenges to overcome. So Angela Rayner, the former Deputy Prime Minister, still entangled with the tax authorities. Wes Streeting, the Health Secretary, seen as a protege of Lord Mandelson, albeit he has been publicly, Mr. Streeting, criticising Lord Mandelson in the strongest possible terms in the last few days. Andy Burnham, the Mayor of Manchester, is still the Mayor of Greater Manchester, not running in that by-election. Incidentally, someone pointed out to me last night a quirk of the timing of politics. Imagine the news about Lord Mandelson had come a fortnight ago and we were only just learning about the by-election in Greater Manchester now. Would the Prime Minister in that instance have had the political authority to block Andy Burnham running for a vacancy, yes, in the by-election, but also potentially for Prime Minister, that is looking much more likely now than it did a fortnight ago?
Chris Mason, our political editor, thank you, as always.
It's coming up to 8:30. Time for the sport. Here's Carthy.
Morning headlines first, and stoppage time and VAR drama provided an important 2-1 win for Manchester City at Liverpool yesterday, which in the context of the Premier League title race is a big result for second place City, who have cut Arsenal's lead to 6 points. There was almost a huge shock involving England at the T20 Men's Cricket World Cup, with Nepal taking it down to the final ball of the game, England eventually winning by just 4 runs. Ireland lost to Sri Lanka by 20 runs and Scotland are in action at the moment in Kolkata against Italy. Scotland set Italy a target of 208. Italy are 133 for 8, with 4 overs remaining in that game. Overnight, the Seattle Seahawks beat the New England Patriots 29-13 to claim their second Super Bowl victory. I've just been speaking to the American football reporter Anthony Wooten, who was at that game in California, about the impact of that second title on the Seahawks.
It's been shot all around the world, screened around the world, the celebrations, the story of the Seattle Seahawks. And with that will come new fans. And you only have to look as closely as Germany to us. And the biggest fan base outside of Washington State, Seahawks fan base, is Germany. And that's because of the success that they had at the Super Bowl in 2014. So this marks a new era for the Seattle Seahawks and just brings that global recognition for, you know, one of the smaller market teams, I think, within the NFL and in the country over here in the USA.
Yeah, that new fans element is interesting. There was no touchdown until the fourth quarter. How is the game itself being reflected on?
Well, there's always this classic phrase in the NFL, which is defenses win championships. And certainly defenses won championships today. It was a defensive struggle, especially in the first half. And the Seattle Seahawks kicker, Jason Myers, actually broke the Super Bowl record for most field goals kicked in a Super Bowl. So it kind of tells you the story of this game. So it was strong defensive performance until the fourth quarter. And then finally, we had this explosion of touchdowns. The Seattle Seahawks got a touchdown at the start of the fourth quarter. And then straight away, the New England Patriots went down the field and scored a touchdown. You think, okay, here we go. This is game on. The fourth quarter lived up to expectations. Everything else was kind of, if you were neutral watching it and you're watching it back in England or in the UK, you might have gone to bed.
Yeah, interesting that the Seahawks have a British defence coach as well. And I've seen Bad Bunny's halftime show described as a big love letter to his native Puerto Rico. We're talking about that more in the programme, but just give us a flavour of what it was like inside that stadium overnight.
Yes, you know what? It was a very good atmosphere. There were lots of Seattle Seahawks fans here. They were very noisy when the New England Patriots were on offense. So they are known as the 12s, the 12th man, because there are 11 players on the field. And the 12s were very raucous. Their head coach in the post-game press conference talked about the impact that the Seattle Seahawks fans had on the game and for their team. So they were very loud. The halftime show was, it was a party. You know, Bad Bunny earlier in the week, he'd said in his press conference that he was asked, you know, were people going to understand your lyrics because they're in Spanish? He says he wanted people to dance and everybody was certainly on their feet and dancing. So he put on a show, Bad Bunny, at halftime. Lady Gaga as well made an appearance, and there are various cameo appearances as well within that halftime show. So the overall mood was very good. It was very positive. You know, there were questions about ice ahead of the game, and there were a few hundreds of people outside the stadium protesting whilst the game was happening. But inside the stadium, it was certainly a feel-good atmosphere, unless, of course, you're a New England Patriots fan.
Well, it sounds like you enjoyed Super Bowl 60. Anthony Whitten, thanks for letting us know all about it.
Thank you.
Scotland have just won that T20 match that I was talking about earlier. They've won it by 73 runs against Italy in Kolkata. And at the Winter Olympics today, look out for Great Britain's Kirsty Muir in the freestyle skiing women's slopestyle final and 19-year-old snowboarder Mia Brooks, who's qualified for the big air final, which is this evening. Great Britain has never won a gold medal on the snow, so history could be made today.
Could be. We'll watch and see. Thank you, Carthy. Now, with details of Start the Week coming up at 9, here's Naomi Alderman. Morning.
Good morning. Here's a Today programme-worthy statistic. In the UK, the video games industry generates more than double the revenue of the steel and fishing industries combined. If that's a surprise, have we got to start the week for you? We're talking to journalist Keza McDonald about how Nintendo, think Super Mario and Pokemon, rewrote the rules of fun, to philosopher C.T. Nguyen about why games know how to push our buttons, and to political journalist Stephen Bush about whether politics itself is a game. On the news this morning, it's apparently the last throw of the dice for the Prime Minister. So, winners and losers on Start of the Week this morning, just after 9.
You can't escape poor Kirsty. There we are. Sure, there's lots else on Start of the Week that you can enjoy there. And indeed you can. What about the weather? This morning's going to be largely cloudy with spots of drizzle. It'll turn dry with some brightness developing in the afternoon. It will, Anna, though, be quite a lot worse in Aberdeen, as we will be discussing.
Oh, we will.
In just a moment.
I do feel
no
sorry for
sunshine
them.
Since the 21st of January.
20 days. That really has an impact on the mood. We'll talk about that very soon. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster. It's 25 to 9. Tom Sanders has a summary of the news.
Sir Keir Starmer will face Labour MPs today in a bid to garner their support following yesterday's resignation of his Chief of Staff Morgan McSweeney over advice he gave to appoint Lord Mandelson as the ambassador to the US. Some Labour MPs say that ultimately was Sir Keir's decision and he should be held accountable. The Skills Minister, Baroness Smith, told us Sir Keir accepted he made the wrong decision about Lord Mandelson, and that's why the Prime Minister was determined to put right the broader issues of misogyny and violence against women and girls. A court in Hong Kong has sentenced the pro-democracy media tycoon Jimmy Lai to 20 years in prison under security laws imposed by China. The Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper has called on the authorities to release the 78-year-old British citizen. The Prince of Wales will meet Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Salman later as he begins his three-day visit to the kingdom. Ministers view the diplomatic relationship between the Gulf state as strategically important, despite concerns about the country's human rights record.
Thank you, Tom. As you were hearing there, the pro-democracy publisher Jimmy Lai has been sentenced to 20 years in prison in Hong Kong. Taiwan has said his jailing on national security charges creates a chilling effect that will be felt across borders. Human Rights Watch has described it as effectively a death sentence due to his age. He is 78 years old. He is a British citizen, and Sir Keir Starmer said he'd raised the case when he visited China just last month. Well, Sebastian Lai is Jimmy Lai's son. Sebastian, good morning.
Good morning.
We spoke to you when the verdict was passed against your father. You were hoping that more would be done, but yet we find ourselves at this moment where he is facing a very long prison sentence, enormously difficult for you and your family and for him.
Yeah, it's incredibly heartbreaking. Though obviously we knew that this, you know, we kind of expected this would happen, but we didn't expect that it would take 5 years. I mean, he's been in solitary confinement for the last 5 years in a maximum security prison. His health has tremendously suffered, and as you would have heard from Human Rights Watch, in 20 years, he's 100. But even if he got another 2-3 years, given his health, given that he has heart issues, given that he's lost 10 kilos of last year alone, that's basically a death sentence.
What have the British government said to you about what they're doing to try and secure his freedom?
So the British government essentially said that the case was raised when Sir Keir Starmer was over in Beijing. The idea was, I mean, I guess what they've said is that by going to China, it gives an opportunity to raise these human rights cases. But obviously my father is still in prison. And I think, look, if we talk about closer relationship, if we talk about warming of relationship, normalization of relationship, well, I think for most people listening to this, isn't putting a 78-year-old man on a plane and sending him back here a very easy way for Hong Kong and China to do that?
When they said to you that the case was raised, that could mean any one of a number of things. Did they give you any more detail than that?
They just said there was raised at the highest level, which again which was echoed by the Prime Minister again.
Does that feel like it was enough for you?
Obviously, I'd like to see my father again. I haven't seen him in 5 years, every single day that passes is one of those scary moments where I could get a text anytime saying that, you know, unfortunately, because of the conditions he's in, because of his age, that he passed away. So, I miss him a lot.
Yeah, I'm conscious that this is enormously difficult for you because you want to pull every lever that you possibly can, and you need to be diplomatic in the things that you say. But as you also say, time is of the essence. Yeah. You know, he's already been in solitary confinement for 5 years. And what is your direct message to those who may be listening right now, who may be able to do something about this? What would you say to them?
I think my direct message is that, you know, here you have in my father's story a man who's given up everything. He arrived in Hong Kong as a child stowaway and decided to dedicate his life to defending the freedoms of Hong Kong and stayed and defended these principles, defended his colleagues. And for that heroism, he's being punished. He's essentially getting a death sentence for that. And if we can't, if we look at his story, surely a man who has given so much for liberty, for freedom, deserves a bit of it himself. And I think that's why it's so important to call for his release, and to secure his release, and to bring him back home here to the UK.
Sebastian Lai, thank you for joining us. Jimmy Lai's son. The Foreign Office have put out just a brief statement on this morning. You heard what the Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper had to say. The Foreign Office says it will rapidly engage further with Chinese authorities on Jimmy Lai's case.
It's now 8:40. Time for the weather forecast. Grey, drizzle, rain, absolutely no sunshine. That at least is the forecast for Aberdeen. Not just today, it has been the forecast for Aberdeen pretty much each and every day since the 21st of January, the last time that the sun was spotted. And it is beginning to get Aberdonians down, as these folk made clear when they spoke to BBC Scotland.
It doesn't make you happy, is it? And let's face it, Aberdeen's grey as it is it?
So I feel like I'm constantly wet and cold. But other than that, you just have to get on with it. Brighter days are coming.
Brighter days are coming, says one of the people on the streets there. Trying to cheer them up is a woman known as the Psychology Mum on Instagram. She's got many, many followers, thousands of followers. Dr. Emma Hepburn, who's a clinical psychologist and Aberdonian. Morning to you. Another day without the sun.
Yes, it's a bit grey here today.
You had enough?
Yeah, well, Aberdeen's a really nice city. You know, we've got the beach on their doorstep, lots of green spaces. But anywhere when it's dreich, as we call it here, dreich basically means grey, dark, cold, and it's windy as well. You know, it's hard to access those places and keep going and see the city or see what we, or do what we want to do. So yeah, it's a bit wet today and dark.
And hard to access positivity, isn't it? However much you think about, I must stay cheerful, it has an effect directly on the brain.
Yeah, absolutely. And it has not just an effect directly on the brain. So a lack of sunlight, lack of light can impact on kind of brain chemicals, which can make it, us feel lethargic, make it more difficult to kind of feel good. But it can also have a knock-on impact. So, if we're feeling lethargic and it's wet and grey outside, we can be less motivated to go out and do the things that we want to do. It's just harder. And that then kind of reduces our protective factors, things that make us feel good, the things that keep our mood elevated and that give us meaning. So it's not just the direct impact, it's a knock-on impact as well.
So what do you advise people to do? How? Because they can't change the weather.
Yeah, no, we can't. I think that first of all, it's important to say that some people are significantly affected by it. And if you are concerned about your mood, speak to a GP or healthcare provider. But there are things we can do on a kind of day-to-day basis. There's some evidence for light lamps and some people benefit from that. So that's always worth trying. If there is any light, get out into as much as you can. Try and get out if you can. And I think, it's very easy just to hunker down and do things. There's nothing wrong with that, but try and engage in some ways and activities you enjoy. If you're finding difficult to get out to the gym, if that's what you enjoy, can you do something at home instead? So still engage in those activities that you enjoy doing.
It sounds a little bit like lockdown, this.
We had 2 weeks of snow before the cold weather, so that was probably more like lockdown than the greyness, to be honest.
But you're determined to stay cheerful, Dr. Hepburn.
Absolutely. And I think that's really important to have things to look forward to. And remember, it is temporary. We usually have a nice spring in Scotland. So let's fingers crossed that we have got that to look forward to.
Well, I hope you're right. I'm sure you're right. Of course you are. Dr. Emma Hepburn there, the Psychology Mum on Instagram. Thanks.
17 minutes to nine. All 29-year-olds in France are about to receive an official letter from the government telling them to have babies. This is because the country is dealing with a falling birth rate. So politicians have decided that contacting everyone before they turn 30 to warn them about their ticking biological clock, let them know about what fertility treatment's available if they're struggling, is the right way to deal with the problem. It's one of the ways, at least. Anne-Cécile Méfer is the president of the Women's Foundation in France. Good morning.
Good morning.
Is this a good idea?
Well, not really. Instead of sending a letter to young people, our president should actually listen to young people because the decline in birth rate is not a fertility crisis. I mean, not mainly. It's more of a life condition crisis. Infertility does exist, of course, and it matters for people who experience it. But statistically, it explains only a very small part of the decline in number of children per woman. What young adults across Europe actually consistently say is something much simpler. They're postponing or having fewer children because life has become hard. Housing is expensive, work is precarious, the cost of living is rising, the future is uncertain. So government should really want people to have children. The answer is not to lecture them about infertility. The answer is to make life more livable.
Is there a sense from young people in France, and particularly the ones who are about to receive this letter, that the government is perhaps being tone deaf on those points?
The government is deaf. Yes, the government is not listening to them. And the government is more actually the biggest fear that I have is that the government is actually listening to the most conservative part of France. I mean, not just France, actually, also in Europe and in the US. As you might have heard, the declining birth rate has become a major political talking point. because it has been amplified by a conservative media ecosystem and ultra wealthy people who own them, like Vincent Bolloré in France. They are like every day they are publishing articles about that failing birth rate, and they are telling a story that failing birth rates is a threat to national survival. And that language is not neutral. It does echo to this narrative about the great replacement theory, you know, like the idea that white populations are being replaced by immigrants. And this narrative is deeply rooted in racial anxiety, in racism, and it has become increasingly mainstream in political discourse in France. And we also have, you know, masculinist movement and those young men that are also using the birth rate debate to argue that women should return to more traditional roles, less career, more motherhood. So what looks like a demographic discussion is actually something more political, more cultural. It's really a battle about gender roles, about immigration, about identity, about a lot of things that have nothing to do with demography.
Mm. I'm hearing all of the wider points that you're making there. I suppose looping back, the one bit of the letter, and I know you said that fertility issues were not the main cause of the declining birth rate, but it looks like there is going to be an increase in the number of fertility preservation centres, that the research is going to go into it, that money is going to be spent, that might help at least a section of the population who do need some sort of assistance when it comes to conceiving.
Yes, you're right. And all the public policies in favor of people's health, of public people's health, is a good thing. In France, we have 1 out of 5 couples that will need to receive a treatment in order to conceive a child. So yes, it is a real subject, and it does matter for the people who are going through those experiences and that are like very complicated and difficult ones. However, to me, it shouldn't be the answer to the failing of the birth rate, because the answer of failing of the birth rate is actually more the life conditions. And we should have a broader debate, not just about infertility, but a broader debate on life conditions of housing, working system, the future, and giving more perspective, more joyful perspective and more positive perspective than a perspective of a global war, for instance.
Things that you mentioned. Anne-Cécile Méfer, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it. President of the Women's Foundation in France.
It's now 12 minutes to 9.
Noel Gallagher of Oasis is set to win Songwriter of the Year at this year's Brit Awards in recognition of timeless classics like Wonderwall, Champagne Supernova and Don't Look Back in Anger. Announcing news, Stacey Tang, who's chair of the Brit Awards Committee, co-president of RCA Records, said that Noel Gallagher was responsible for crafting bold, brilliant and always recognisable songs for more than 3 decades, which is true, but there is a small issue here, which is that he hasn't released any new music since 2023, which has led some songwriters to question how he can be Songwriter of the Year in 2026. Helen Brown is a music journalist. Morning, Helen.
Good morning. Yeah, it's a bit of a shocker, isn't it?
You can see where they're coming from, can't you? And there is the suggestion that because for the first time the Brits are being held outside London this year, they've moved to Manchester, that might be perhaps part of it.
Oh, I'm sure that's the reason. You know, this is a great move for Manchester. It's the first time in the Brit Awards' 48-year history that it's coming from Manchester. And I'm sure they had to give Noel Gallagher, you know, they need Noel Gallagher to rock up. And they needed to give him some kind of gong. But for goodness sake, why not Tour of the Year? Last year's Oasis tour was a spectacular event. It unified the nation. It put generations and political divisions aside, and the nation had a big old sing-along. So those are great songs, but they are 30 years old. And we've got so many young artists coming up. So we should have given him something like Tour of the Year. And then what we should have done is had Noel Gallagher out to open the show. You know, go mad for it. Big on Manchester. Get him to introduce some of the spectacular new young talent. You know, we've got amazing new Manchester artists like West Side Cowboy, Jasmine Fatih, creating really distinctive new British music. And he should have then introduced a younger generation and celebrated that. You know, they should have gone for what's happening now in Manchester.
Yeah, it seems like a simple solution. And I suppose one of the other issues about it being the songwriting prize is that's one of the more cerebral awards. It's one of the ones that artists take really, really seriously because they feel that that is the moment when they're showing off their craft.
It is. And I think it's one of the, you know, when I interview pop stars and rock stars, it's one of the awards that they're proud to tell me about. You know, no one's that chuffed about the, you know, the video of the year or whatever. But that one is a real acknowledgement of your talent. And I suppose the only possible reason they're giving this to Noel Gallagher is because everything else acknowledges him and his brother. So maybe we're back in feud territory.
Split the difference.
And of course, Noel writes the song. So if he can't get Liam to come to Manchester for the Brits, then the only way to distinguish them is to, you know, acknowledge the songwriting, which is the part that Noel does.
Yeah. Final quick thought, Helen. Do you think it will stay like this? Or given that there's been a bit of a backlash, do you think they might perhaps take the off-ramp that you were suggesting there and change the award?
I don't know. It would be lovely if they did. As I say, there are some, you know, and we've had spectacular albums out this year by British artists. You know, we should acknowledge the songwriting of people like Olivia Dean, Lola Young, Sam Fender. I mean, for goodness sake, if you want to go for an older artist, Lily Allen broke the internet last year with a very distinctively British sound, you know, with her West End Girl album. So, you know, I really hope they rethink, but I doubt they will because these things tend to be locked in at industry contract level way in advance.
Yeah. Helen Brown, music journalist, thank you for being with us this morning.
8 minutes to nine, just a chance for a last word on the story of the day. Should Keir Starmer follow his chief of staff out of Downing Street as a result of the crisis created by the appointment of Peter Mandelson, even though it was known that he was still friends with a convicted paedophile? Reflecting on that for us, chief political commentator at The Times and author of two rather important books about the Labour Party, its recent history, Patrick Maguire, and also Tom McTague, who edits the New Statesman magazine, which remains the most influential magazine for supporters of the Labour Party. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You wrote last week, Patrick Maguire, that, let's just say it, he'll soon be gone. Have you changed your mind as a result of McSweeney? Do you think it speeds it up or slows it down?
I think it definitely speeds it up. Keir Starmer has never led the Labour Party without Morgan McSweeney. He's never thought about leading the Labour Party with Morgan McSweeney. This, for better or worse, was Morgan McSweeney's Labour Party. It's full of Morgan McSweeney's people, one of whom, of course, was Peter Mandelson. It's a bold experiment at this point of acute weakness for Keir Starmer to introduce an entirely new style of leadership. And I think the results are going to be predictable because at no stage has Keir Starmer shown the political ability or inclination to do politics, to make arguments, to sustain arguments. And that's exactly what he needs to do now. And he also doesn't have the aide to whom he was closest and on whom he relied to tell him and to help shape the politics for any given moment.
Tom McTague.
While I agree with all of that, I also think there is a way in which Keir Starmer hangs on for a little bit longer. Now, we don't know what's going on inside the mind of Keir Starmer, how he's feeling over the weekend, what conclusions he's made. So this could all change very quickly. But I think a couple of things to think about. First of all, it now makes sense for a leadership contest to be delayed, not just for, obviously, for Keir Starmer, but for the main contenders for his job, for Andy Burnham, who's not in Parliament, for Angela Rayner, who's currently being investigated over the HMRC tax issues, and for Wes Streeting, who has a long-standing relationship with Peter Mandelson. So for those three candidates, there's an incentive to delay it. And one other point, I think, on McSweeney is that he was a challenge for a lot of people in the Labour Party, a lot of Labour MPs. Now, there is a way that Keir Starmer can use this to move a little bit to the left and to be a bit reassuring to Labour MPs who were angry with Morgan McSweeney.
Normally, a change of leader, Patrick Maguire, requires either a very clear policy shift. In the case of Margaret Thatcher being removed, it was ending the poll tax, for example, shifting away from her hostility to Europe, and or it needs a clear successor who is going to be more popular and more successful. The problem with the Labour Party is it hasn't got either of those things, has it?
No, indeed. Look, there is a sort of latent desire to, in a post-McSweeney world, be a real Labour Party, whatever that means. And for a lot of Labour MPs, it means ditching the sort of strictures of Rachel Reeves' fiscal rules, probably Rachel Reeves herself, sounding a little bit nicer on questions of culture and national identity and hard borders. But there are hard and fast rules to our politics. Now, the bond market is one of them. Public sentiment on immigration is another. And there isn't a clear successor, as you and Tom have both accurately pointed out. But we're approaching a point where the electoral reckoning the Labour Party is facing, we'll have one in Gorton and Denton, then we'll have one in May, will just be so apocalyptic that the desire, the clamour for something different, for someone who might prove a little bit less unpopular than Keir Starmer, I think is going to be unanswerable.
It's interesting, Patrick, if I may, I just bring Tom in on this, that in your magazine, online, of course, now, as well as a magazine, you have published a piece by Neil Lawson, long-term critic of New Labour and inverted commas, essentially saying, look, it's not really about Starmer. It's not about personalities. It's not about McSweeney. It is about this project that's been going on ever since Tony Blair took over the Labour Party, and it should stop.
Well, yes, I mean, I think it's not just about the project of the left or the Labour Party, but there is something much deeper going on here, isn't there, that we all need to confront, whether we're on the left or the right of politics, in that Morgan McSweeney is just the latest chief of staff in Number 10 to resign, having, in a sense, failed. We can go back through Dominic Cummings and Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill with Theresa May, but we can go back through almost all chiefs of staff, modern chiefs of staff, and prime ministers. Since the 2008 financial crash, there has been no stability in British politics, no growth, and as a result, there has been no project to turn this country around. This is at the heart of what's going on here.
So there are fundamentals there, but you believe, Patrick McGuire, that there is one fundamental about Keir Starmer. In the headline on your column last week, Keir Starmer's hollowness is clear for all to see. What do you mean?
I mean that Keir Starmer has, in a broad sense, progressive values, but has never been a true politician. He dislikes politics. He's disinclined to set out a vision for the country, and everything in his pursuit of power has proven to be expendable. Morgan McSweeney is just the latest thing he's chucked away because it's an obstacle to him remaining in power. He's occupied every conceivable position within the Labour Party. So, you know, it's not surprising that the idea that kicking Morgan McSweeney out, the only person who did give him a degree of consistency, is not going to help him in the long run. Because
You published an essay, Tom McTague, in the New Statesman, a profile you spent a long time with Keir Starmer. And my memory of that is, at the end of it, you were no clearer what he believed than when you began.
Yes, I mean, Keir Starmer has, he struggles to articulate what he feels about British politics, about what he is in British politics to achieve. And this is at the heart of his problem, as Patrick has said. There are flashes of Keir Starmer when he came off the Labour Party conference speech and he said, that was me. That was the real me. He needs to tell that to the British people.
Well, let's end with a flash from both of you, a flash of the future. Who's Prime Minister in a year's time? It's a guess, Patrick. But who might it be?
I think John Healey or Siobhan Mahmood.
Tom McTay.
Yvette Cooper or Ed Miliband.
Fascinating. No one said Keir Starmer, but they might have done. It's been quite a day. There will be more days to come. Patrick McGuire, chief political commentator at The Times. Tom McTague, editor of The New Statesman. Thank you very much for joining us.
Goes without saying that Sarah and Evan will be keeping a very close eye.